Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
What are your thoughts really on gun control and in the system of white supremacy?
Well, Ivan, you've been a student for a long time at the Institute, and you know I talk about racism being a system to prevent white genetic annihilation local, nationally, and globally. And I maintain that the gun has a level of significance, symbolic as well as functional, in that because the system is about the white minority population on the planet maintaining the power relationship with non-white people, of white power over a relative non-white powerlessness.
President Obama is preparing to take executive action on gun control when he returns from vacation next week. The president was rebuffed 3 years ago in his effort to push gun legislation through Congress. Now he's considering regulatory changes that would make it harder for would-be gun buyers to skirt the laws requiring background checks. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
President Obama has spoken out about gun violence more than a dozen times since taking office. Whether the trigger pullers are inspired by ISIS, racism, or the demons of mental illness, for him, the mounting body count has become all too routine.
As I said just a few months ago, and I said a few months before that, and I said each time we see one of these mass shootings, our thoughts and prayers are not enough.
Obama launched a major push for gun control legislation 3 years ago after the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School. But that bill stalled in the U.S. Senate. So after another mass shooting in October at an Oregon community college, the president asked his advisors about steps he could take on his own.
It cannot be this easy for somebody who wants to inflict harm on other people to get his or her hands on a gun.
One recommendation is to tighten the rule governing background checks. Under federal law, licensed gun dealers are required to check customers' background before selling a gun, but hobbyists and collectors are allowed to sell guns with no questions asked.
That is a huge loophole in the existing background check system, which otherwise is a very useful system for keeping guns out of the hands of dangerous people.
Research director Ted Alcorn of the advocacy group Every Town for Gun Safety says a small number of gun sellers have taken advantage of that loophole, selling large numbers of weapons at gun shows and online. Chelsea Parsons of the left-leaning Center for American Progress says these unlicensed dealers make it far too easy for felons, domestic abusers, and the mentally ill to buy guns without any screening.
You have individuals who rent tables at gun shows, set up their wares right next to a licensed gun dealer, and in fact, they often advertise no paperwork, no background check.
Gun control advocates say the administration could shrink that loophole by rewriting the rule so more gun dealers have to conduct background checks. Anyone selling large numbers of guns or turning them around quickly, for example, would have to screen their customers. Critics complain the Senate already considered and rejected a similar idea 3 years ago. Dudley Brown of the National Association for Gun Rights argues Obama is trying to sidestep Congress.
we don't have a king in America, but he's acting like it. We'll oppose it loudly and vociferously.
Brown is based in Colorado, which passed its own law requiring more background checks in 2013 in response to the Aurora movie theater shooting. Two state lawmakers who backed that measure were later recalled. Brown predicts similar political pushback if Obama goes through with his plans.
I think it's going to dramatically hurt Hillary Clinton, members of Congress, and the Democrat Party if the White House does this.
Despite the political fallout, though, Colorado still requires nearly all gun purchasers to go through a background check. Supporters say over the last 2.5 years, that's stopped more than 700 prohibited people from buying a gun. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
All around the world.
Yeah.
World nigga law.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. You might think it was the U.S., but Brazil was the last country in the Americas to abolish slavery in 1888. And despite the huge contribution of African culture to Brazil, the facts about how black people got there are kind of paved over. Literally. Over the past few years, archaeologists have been sifting through the remains of one of the world's largest slave ports, the Valongo Wharf in downtown Rio de Janeiro. It was uncovered in 2011 during an urban redevelopment project the country hopes to showcase at next summer's Olympics. Afro-Brazilian groups are now pushing for the area to be memorialized. And they turn to a young American landscape architect, Sarah Zodi, a designer who's currently working in Seattle. Along the way, Sarah's become something of an expert on Afro-Brazilian history.
The name Valongo has always had significance and been central to Afro-Brazilian oral history. And so it's always been present in songs and in ritual. And the neighborhood has that presence too, a sort of centrality within Afro-Brazilian tradition. But nobody knew how well preserved the ruins were. I mean, they're not even ruins is almost not the right word. They're not ruined. They're there.
Describe it for us.
So basically what you see is the stone jetty over the water where the slave ships actually docked onto. And so this represents the point at which the Africans moved from the ships to the land. So what you find there under the street is the actual stone jetty structure that was built over the water. Now, there have been a number of landfill operations, so now this site is not over the water, it's in the middle of the city. But it is an important point in the voyage, you know, in the transatlantic slave trade. It's the actual point where the feet of the Africans stepped into the New World.
And what else is there?
So the whole neighborhood is basically an archaeological site. So you have an open burial ground just down the road. You have the actual warehouses where these Africans were kept for 2 to 3 weeks for fattening.
Wow.
You also have little plazas in the neighborhood, which have no marker today, but historically they served as the place for the buying and selling and reselling of Africans. And so the whole neighborhood and its infrastructure was built around this industry. Today it functions as a neighborhood. And so, you know, my project as an architect was really about how do we talk about this city and this neighborhood and its form in relationship to that history.
And what are your plans for Valongo Wharf? I know you're designing a memorial or a way to preserve this kind of awful chapter of Brazilian history. What are your ideas for it?
The word memorial and its associated forms are really tied closely to the notion of an event, you know, a war, a hero, a tragedy, something outside of the norm. And, you know, the transatlantic slave trade was not an event. It was 400 years of the way the world operated. Its effects, you know, are still present today. And so it's not something that we can preserve as a moment in time. And so translating that into a form became, you know, not having a wall with names on it or anything, a discrete form, but rather it became an entire sort of toolkit for the neighborhood and all the plazas, including the Valongo Wharf itself, the burial ground, and tying together elements to bring the whole neighborhood together. And those elements were really three things. One, a white ribbon form. Afro-Brazilian belief which comes from largely from West Africa, they believe that when you mark something with a white fabric, it represents where the ancestors gather. And they usually use that around Afro-Brazilian plant species that have a lot of spirit, a lot of energy, a lot of axé is what it's called. And so the second element is the plants that the Afro-Brazilians brought from Africa, trees and plants that offer shade, but also serve as a marker tying these sites to their history. The third piece, it's about the red latticillic tropical soils that bring together with Southwest Africa and Rio de Janeiro. So the third element is a red clay brick paver. Again, that sort of pieces together the disparate parts of this history in the neighborhood, allowing the resident or the visitor to understand the extent of the industry in the neighborhood.
You are the daughter of immigrants from Ethiopia. Did that play any role in terms of how are you perceived or your own interest in it?
Sure. In terms of my interest, I think growing up, you know, in a family of Ethiopian immigrants, I think they always reminded me of the sort of long-term history of our people. They always remind me of this sort of glorious past and glorious future. And so it's sort of in that way that I've always approached architecture and working with different people. So I think in that way, it's been fundamental that everyone has sort of a glorious potential, or, you know, I think it's sort of in this more subtle meta way that being an Ethiopian, second generation Ethiopian, has been influential.
Sarah Zodi is owning it. She's the landscape architect behind a proposed new memorial to what was the world's largest slave port in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
You ain't nothing but white trash. White trash.
This next story starts with six words from a woman who uses a jarring phrase to describe herself.
I'm Tracy Hart from Washington, D.C., and my six words are, yes, I'm tobacco picking white trash.
Yes, I'm tobacco picking white trash. We've heard those words thanks to the Race Card Project, in which people have candid and sometimes uncomfortable conversations around race and cultural identity, beginning with six words they send to the founder of the Race Card Project, our colleague Michelle Norris. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, Steve.
How often do you get the phrase white trash in your inbox?
It lands in the inbox fairly often. You know, people come to the Race Card Project to talk about cultural identity, and sometimes, yes, that has to do with skin color, but a lot of times it has to do with geography and where they happen to come from. And so we get a lot of submissions that deal with fairly pejorative terms or stereotypes, things like hillbilly, redneck, hayseed, bumpkin, and yes, white trash. And people are sometimes writing about pain, sometimes they're using humor to distance themselves from the pain, sometimes it's associated with a kind of nostalgia. For Tracy Hart, it's sort of all of those things. And she actually sent a little essay to explain what she meant by those six words.
Yes, I'm from a tobacco-picking southern white trash family, and I mean that in the most endearing way. Some stereotypes my family breaks. We were southern, but poor sharecroppers rather than slave owners. Other stereotypes my family embraces, using discriminatory language in equal measure across all those who are not white Southerners.
She's reminding us there that the phrase white trash goes way back. It does imply people who settled the southern United States at one time and were not the people who were well off, not the white people who ended up owning giant plantations and slaves. So where does Tracy Hart fit in that picture of white trash?
She would probably be somewhere on the fringe. Tracy Hart is a water resource economist who works at the World Bank in a fairly, you know, sort of intellectually elite setting. Her colleagues might be surprised to hear her describe herself in this way. She is divorced. She has a daughter. She was raised in Texas outside of Houston, and most of her relatives lived throughout the South. And she spent her summers visiting them, often visiting relatives who were just getting by.
I have a great uncle, Uncle Reese, who was living near Independence, Virginia. He died within the last 10 years, never having had indoor plumbing, never having had electrical wiring in his house, never having had a telephone line to his house. The water for the kitchen came from the stream through a PVC pipe, then dumped into a sink, and then there was an egress PVC pipe that took it back to the stream downhill. And that was the only running water in the house.
And we should say, Steve, Tracy Hart's grandmother grew up in that house. She's come some distance from that now. She's one of the most educated members of her family. And tobacco picking that she mentioned was not just a metaphor. It helped pay for her education. From the very beginning, her interest and ambitions set her apart from many members of her family. She had an interest in opera. She became a trained opera singer. She went to school at UC Berkeley. She's lived overseas for several years. She says that she speaks 10 different languages. And so she's used to crossing cultural bridges. But she says the hardest bridge for her to cross is when she returns home and faces the judgment of her rural, geographically isolated family.
Why would her family be judging her?
Well, she says they're sort of judging each other. And because it's family, it's complicated. I actually asked her about this. The term white trash is something that you have embraced, if I can use that word, or you say, yes, that's me.
Mm-hmm.
But would your family members say that?
I think my family might think that I'm being a bit uppity in saying that, because I'm able to admit it because I've stepped out of it. It's where I'm from, but it's not.
So you're saying it looking over your shoulder.
Yeah, I've stepped out of it. It's where I'm from, but it's not where I'm at.
White trash is a pejorative term. It is judgmental. It is harsh. It is mean. If you were to say that to someone, they're just white trash. That would not be a kind thing to say. Is it embraced in some way so that a term that could be used as a cudgel, as a weapon, as a slur, is instead embraced and used as a shield?
Absolutely. I mean, I have members of my family who will say something about, yeah, that's just because we're white trash, and laugh. And if someone else said that, they would not be amused. But within the family, using it is okay.
Is there sort of an easy judgment that is made about white Americans who live at or near the poverty line? Is this sort of an acceptable slur or stereotype?
I don't know if it is for the North, but in the Deep South, it is. You know, as you might say, it's owned by, or it's been taken back or embraced by a significant part of poor people in the Deep South who feel misunderstood to some extent. They feel misunderstood because of the heavy legacy of slavery and segregation and poverty. And I think part of their feeling misunderstood is to take on or embrace that term, which is self-denigrating, but it also says, you know, we've been hurt too.
What do you want people to take from this? People who are listening to it, people who go to the website and encounter your story. You sent in 6 words, you sent in an essay, you sent in a photo.
At the time, I wondered about the photo. I wondered about taking ownership of this. However, if we can't name ourselves and name those small differences, we have many, many cultural attributes in common, and yet it's the few cultural attributes we don't have in common that label us. And so that's why I wrote that. Not that I've ever expected anyone to read it, but I wrote it to put it on the paper to say, here I stand, this is who I am, and if I'm going to understand anyone else, I'm going to understand myself first.
That's Tracy Hart talking with NPR's Michelle Norris, founder of the Race Card Project. And you can read more 6-word stories and write your own at theracecardproject.com. Michelle, thanks for bringing this story by.
Good to be with you, Steve.
See, now, from, in other words, Hillary and Donald are people classified as white. And so if we say, well, the Republicans and the Democrats are just two wings of the racist and white supremacy party.
Let's locate our country on a scale from racism to political correctness. Donald Trump puts it here.
I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct. I've been challenged by so many people, and I don't frankly have time for total political correctness. And to be honest with you, this country doesn't have time either.
Donald Trump in the August debate, but in Saturday night's Democratic debate, referring to white working class Americans, Bernie Sanders put it here.
And somebody like a Trump comes along and says, I know the answers. The answer is that all of the Mexicans, they're criminals and rapists. We got to hate the Mexicans. Those are your enemies. We hate all the Muslims because all of the Muslims are terrorists. We got to hate the Muslims. Meanwhile, the rich get richer.
And in yesterday's Morning Edition interview with Steve Inskeep, President Obama was not as direct at Sanders, but it's clear what he's getting at.
Damn you, Obama.
But I do think that when you combine that demographic change with all the economic stresses that people have been going through because of the financial crisis, because of technology, because of globalization, the fact that wages and incomes have been flatlining for some time, and that particularly blue-collar men have had a lot of trouble in this new economy where they're no longer getting the same bargain that they got when they were going to a factory and able to support their families on a single paycheck. You combine those things, and it means that there is going to be potential anger, frustration, fear. Some of it justified, but just misdirected. You know, I think somebody like Mr. Trump's taken advantage of that. I mean, that's what he's exploiting during the course of his campaign.
President Obama on Morning Edition yesterday. So where are we on a scale from racism to political correctness? Let's talk about it with Slate's chief political correspondent, Jamel Bowie. He has an article called The Dirty Truth Behind Trump's Success. What if Trump is winning because of his racism and bigotry, not despite it? Hi, Jamel. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, this is about the candidates, but it's also even more about who the nation is right now. Call in and tell us how much you see political correctness as a problem, as Trump put it in that clip, and Trump is an antidote to that problem even. Or to answer Jamel Bowie's question, the way the headline of his article posed it, what if Trump is winning because of his racism and bigotry, not despite it? Where are we as a country on that spectrum right now? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Jamel, I guess the given in the question is that Trump is bigoted and racist. Is that your starting point?
Yes. For my part, I don't see how one can challenge that description. Trump began his campaign by decrying Mexican immigrants in particular, but I think Latino immigrants writ large, as rapists who bring crime, which if that isn't at least like a little racist, I'm kind of at a loss of what counts for racism. He's continued in that vein throughout the year. Attributing awful qualities to entire, you know, categories of people on the basis of racial categorization or religious categorization. And so, you know, most recently he has gone after Muslim refugees and immigrants to the United States, calling for a full ban, holding people responsible or even holding people suspect on the basis of their category and on anything they've done.
So goes against conservative principle where everybody's supposed to be treated as an individual. That's why they oppose affirmative action, supposedly, so that everybody is treated as an individual rather than as a member of a group. And then, boom, banned all Muslims from entering the country because. But you cited those Sanders and Obama clips that we just played in your article. What do you think they're getting at in their analysis, not of Trump, but of his supporters?
I think they're getting at a pretty classic liberal analysis of why demagogic figures use bigotry or racism in why it appeals to people, which is that what's happening is underlying economic anxiety, underlying fear about your position in society leaves one susceptible, I can never say that word, to appeals to your base urges. So basically the mechanism is you are afraid for your economic future, but there doesn't seem to be anything that anyone can do or that anyone is offering, but someone can give you a person to blame, and so you latch on to that. But I don't think that may be the case for some Trump voters, but I want people to consider another possibility, which is that racism and bigotry and nativism are interests in themselves, that someone could be economically secure and also believe that society needs to be hostile to religious and ethnic minorities. And if that's the case, and I think that very much is the case, that those people do exist, then Trump support could be as much about a substantive belief in bigotry and nativism as a way to run a society as it is sort of a reflection of sublimated anxiety.
So you think that kind of sociological analysis that the president laid out so rationally there is too sympathetic, rather than just saying there are still a lot of racist white people out there and Trump's playing to them?
Right. I think that's the right way to put it. It's a bit too sympathetic, or at least I think there's a tendency, especially for liberals, to dismiss bigotries of any kind as being fundamentally irrational, that they come from sort of the lizard brain part of a human being. But, you know, in American history, oftentimes bigotries have been tied to a sort of a substantive interest, whether that's a substantive economic interest that you don't want competition. And then in other cases, bigotries have just been, you know, people have wanted them in and of themselves. And so, for instance, Jim Crow was supported by low-income whites, not just because it restricted competition for jobs and housing and education, but also because people bought into the idea of society where whites held preeminent social status in and of itself. Even if they didn't need the restricted competition, they still wanted that.
So let me go to Desmond in Crown Heights. Desmond, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. The lady who just finished speaking, I echo a lot of her sentiments. What you're seeing is the final wave of what happened in Europe when all of the, let's say the U.K., all of the British Empire's people who they had colonized and used their resources for centuries finally came home and basically started creating their own economic force and their own cultural force. And then you saw all the revolts, particularly Brixton. In this country, you've been seeing the same thing. And now this country is facing a demographic surge of the minority population by 2040, some say 2050. And it's the same xenophobic fear. And I remember as a teenager being told by a classmate how he rejected affirmative action for people of color, saying that his family had come here and worked hard as immigrants. He was Greek. Well, my family came from the Caribbean, and they came here and worked hard and had qualifications and couldn't get a job anywhere because they were black. And what you're finding is that the same actions that you see against the president, who was so qualified to be president, and then on the day of his inauguration, they plotted against him, while at the same time they found him to be ineffective mm-hmm. because he was intellectually superior.
Desmond, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you for your take. And Jamel Bowie, I'm curious about your take on the beginning of his call, where he referred to the changing demographics of the country and the fact that by 2042, they say, maybe 2050, maybe much earlier actually, we're going to be a majority-minority country. That is, white people will be at 49.5% instead of 50 plus. How do you think that's playing in here?
So I think part of what might be happening is that phenomena, which I think is represented in sort of profound form by Barack Obama. Obviously, Barack Obama is elected in a country that is still very much majority white, but the fact that Obama could be elected presages a majority-minority future, and the fact that this coalition was so dominated.
Jamel, I'm going to jump in here for a second because we're having – I don't know if you can hear it. We're having a lot of crackling on your mic, and my engineer is going to work with you for a second to see if we can clear that up.
The stars at night are big and bright.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
July 29th, 1910, in Slocum, Texas, started off like any other Friday in this rural East Texas community. But before the day was over, one of the worst racial atrocities in Texas history would happen. It wasn't long after sunrise that the shooting started, and the shooting continued throughout the day. It's been called the Slocum Massacre, the day when the local white community whipped up into hysteria, attacked the black community, killing many, forcing the rest to flee for their lives, and their homes were put to the torch. If you haven't heard of the Slocum Massacre, don't fault yourself. Texas has been silent about what happened here. There is no state historic marker at Slocum explaining the tragic events for travelers who might stop. It's not taught in Texas history classes, and it's not even mentioned in the Texas State Historical Association's Handbook of Texas. Some say it didn't really happen. And others allege that there was a cover-up of the Slocum Massacre, a cover-up that continues even today. This is a special edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. To remember or forget the Slocum Massacre. Saddler Creek still runs in Anderson County, Texas, near where Slocum once stood. It was a modest farming community about 20 miles southeast of Palestine, about 100 miles east of Waco. Saddler Creek runs through the thickly wooded and swampy area, just as it did over 100 years ago, the day when the African-American community was attacked. It was here at daybreak near the creek that the first shots were fired. Three teenagers, African-Americans, Charlie Wilson, Cleve Larkin, and Lusk Holly, were walking down the road and crossed paths with a group of about a half dozen white men. Without warning, the men opened fire. Larkin was killed. Wilson was wounded in the leg and chest. Holly escaped injury and fled with Wilson into the swamp. Soon, there were more packs of armed men combing the area, shooting black people on sight, going from cabin to cabin, working their way through the woods, and continuing their methodical executions. Members of Constant Holly Juwade's family were killed that day in Slocum.
I think it was probably the scariest day of my great-great-grandfather's life. You're trying to protect your sons, yourself, your wife, your children. I think it was terrifying.
Lee Craven is also a descendant of a survivor of the attack on Slocum.
One of my relatives was in fact pursued inside his home and shot point blank range with a rifle while he sought refuge under a bed.
Slocum Massacre, late July 1910, basically a bunch of white folks, mobs of white folks in groups ranging from 12 to 100 to 200, started going around Anderson County, southeast Anderson County primarily, and killing black folks. Killing as many African Americans as they could find, as many as they could chase down over a 24 to 48 hour period.
E.R. Bills is a Texas-based author. His book, The 1910 Slocum Massacre, An Act of Genocide in East Texas, digs into the causes and fallout of the attack. He says it's impossible to determine how many people were killed in the massacre.
There is no official number. The newspaper reports originally suggested two dozen. Eventually, when there were indictments handed down, they were for seven casualties. But the sheriff of the day, or of the time, said that that most of the bodies would be found by the buzzards. There were too many. They were everywhere. And strangely enough, no more were found after he said that. It appears that Some of the perpetrators of the massacre went around covering the evidence, and in fact, some of the black families were retrieving their deceased loved ones to bury them and prevent further abuse. So it's not clear, but oral tradition suggests there were at least 200 killed. And it also led to a racial expulsion. Probably thousands fled. A racial expulsion, that's basically when it's when people flee an area, you know, because they're being persecuted because of their race or their ethnicity. You know, it's happening in parts of the world now. In that period, when the white folks started killing all the black folks they could find, obviously the surviving African-Americans fled. They fled their homes. They fled their properties, their jobs. Some of them fled with nothing more than the clothes on their back. One descendant describes her ancestors telling her, you know, that they had just heard the white folks had gone crazy killing black folks, so they just started fleeing. And in fact, many of the victims in the end were shot in the back. I mean, it wasn't enough that they were fleeing; they were going to kill them, regardless.
The local sheriff of Anderson County at the time, William H. Black, reported that men were going about killing Negroes as fast as they could find them, and so far as I was able to ascertain, without any real cause. All known victims were unarmed, and most were shot in the back. No whites were injured. Reports tallied between 8 and 22 were killed that day, all African Americans, and the real number of fatalities is unknown. There is evidence to suggest that African-American casualties could be as high as 200. Holly Juwade is a descendant of who appears to be the number one target of the white mob.
I am the great-great-granddaughter of Jack Holly and the great-granddaughter of Marsh Holly.
Jack Holly was born a slave, but after emancipation, he was able to become a prosperous landowner and a businessman in Slocum. He was able to survive the attack, but his family had to go on the run. In fear, they even changed the spelling of their last name, and all their property was lost. Holly Juwade has worked for years trying to make sure the victims of the Slocum massacre are not forgotten, and she says she and her family have been hitting brick walls from the local and state historic commission to gain recognition that Slocum happened.
No one wants to hear it because no one wants the story to get out. That is, I truly believe that.
When you know we've been hurt, been down before. Nigga, when our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? Nigga, and we hate po-po, when they kill us dead in the street for sure.
As we turn now to San Francisco, a year-end report from the Mapping Police Violence Research Project says police killed at least 1,152 people in the United States in 2015. In 14 cities, every single police victim was African-American. Sam Sinyangwe is a policy analyst and data scientist with Campaign Zero and Mapping Police Violence. Can you talk about these findings? Because there's been a lot of demand for there even to be data collected in this country around police killings and the racial breakdown of those killings. How did you do this?
So, as you mentioned, the federal government, including the FBI, Bureau of Justice Statistics, and the CDC, do not collect comprehensive data on police killings nationwide. Fortunately, crowdsourced efforts such as KillByPolice.net, FatalEncounters.org have actually been able to collect the type of comprehensive data needed to do this type of analysis. What we did was merge those data sets, fill in the gaps, identify folks by race, whether they were armed or unarmed, and then make sense of all the data, understand which places were sort of hot spots of police violence, and what some of the racial disparities in the data could tell us about how police violence impacts different communities.
So talk about this number, both the over 1,115 people killed by police in the last year, and also this issue of 14 cities. And explain which are these 14 cities where the only people that police killed were African American.
Absolutely. So what we found was that 1,190 people to date have been killed by police in the United States this year. That includes a number of folks, about a quarter of which were in America's 60 largest cities. And so, as you mentioned, 14 of those cities, the police departments actually killed black folks exclusively. And so some of these cities include places like Baltimore, St. Louis, and other places where we've seen significant unrest over some of these practices that seem to target African-American communities. To give you a sense of what that means, nationwide, black folks are 3 times more likely to be killed by police and twice as likely to be unarmed when they're killed by police. And so clearly, these protests, what we're seeing in Chicago and other places, is rooted in an experience of discriminatory policing that needs to end.
Explain how the FBI operates in terms of reporting police killings.
So the FBI relies on a voluntary reporting mechanism. So they basically depend on police departments to report accurate information on police killings. And as we've seen in entire states and sometimes in individual jurisdictions, police departments have not stepped up and provided that data. And so actually the best data on police killings nationwide comes from local media reports. So when somebody is killed by police, usually, actually almost all the time, it is mentioned in the media. And so by culling those reports, aggregating them, and then coding them by various characteristics of the incidents, we're able to come up with these numbers.
What correlation is there, Sam, between high crime rates and high police killing rates?
So it's an interesting question. What we've heard, particularly from the right, is—and from police folks, is that there is a connection between violent crime in communities and police violence. That, as they say, that communities with a lot of crime have more police, and police get in more situations where they use force. However, what we found with the data is that that actually is not true, that there are communities with a lot of crime, places like Newark and Detroit, some of the most high-crime cities in the country, that have comparatively fewer police killings than places that actually have much lower crime, places like Bakersfield. And so, actually, when you map this across, one of the things that we've done with the 60 largest cities at mappingpoliceviolence.org is we actually show the correlation that, in fact, there is no correlation between the level of crime in a city, violent crime, and the rate of police killings in that city.
Can you talk about this last two killings of African-Americans this weekend in Chicago? What does this say? How does this fit into the data you've found around Chicago?
So, you know, the killing of Betty Jones and Quintonio actually shows us that, you know, it's part of a broader pattern and practice of discriminatory policing, policing that targets African Americans. So, for example, since 2013, so 2013, 14 and 15, Chicago police have killed 46 people. 72% of those people have been black. Over 95% have been people of color. And so when we look at the disparities in the data, it's clear that police in Chicago are applying a different standard to African Americans in particular than they are to other communities. And I think that is what is undergirding and is a context for a lot of the unrest that we see.
What are the cities with the highest rates of police killing, Sam?
So a couple of cities. One, Oklahoma City, consistently. This year has been the second highest rate of police killings. Last year was number one. Bakersfield, California is another city. St. Louis, another city that have among the highest rates of police killings in the nation. To give you a sense for how high we're talking, black men were actually killed by police at a rate higher than the U.S. murder rate in St. Louis last year. That is true for 17 of the 100 largest cities in America.
Based on the data that you have reviewed, what are you calling for?
So really, we're calling for transformation in the way that policing operates in this country. We have launched a platform, Campaign Zero, at joincampaignzero.org, which articulates a 10-point plan for ending police violence in America. It includes things like empowered civilian oversight, ensuring that there is video evidence, so protecting the right of citizens to film the police and having body cameras, independent investigations and prosecutions, limits on the use of force, the policies that govern the use of force, as well as things like fair police union contracts, so making sure that police union contracts do not have provisions that, for example, delete officers' records of past misconduct. So in Chicago, for example, the police union contract actually mandates that officers' disciplinary records be deleted and destroyed after 5 years. So there are many officers that actually may have a history of violence that we actually do not know about because the union contract mandates that information be removed.
Samson Yangwe, I want to thank you for being with us, policy analyst and data scientist, member of the planning team of Campaign Zero and Mapping Police Violence, speaking to us from San Francisco.
I want to be a cop.
After a year of investigations in Cleveland, there will be no criminal charges against the police officers involved in the shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice. That news came from Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Tim McGinty on Monday.
A short time ago, we informed Tamir's mother of the grand jury's decision. We explained to her that this was a difficult decision, but that to charge police, even a situation what was as undeniably tragic as the death of her son, the state must be able to show that the officers acted outside the constitutional boundaries set forth by the Supreme Court of these United States. Simply put, given this perfect storm of human error, mistakes, and miscommunications by all involved that day, the evidence did not indicate criminal conduct by police.
But for the Rice family, the shooting and subsequent investigation was symptomatic of much more than a perfect storm of human error. In a statement released by their lawyers, the Rices accused McGinty of, quote, abusing and manipulating the grand jury process. For more on the case's handling and the reaction from Cleveland, we turn to ML Schultze, WKSU digital editor and reporter. Schultze, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much for having me.
That perfect storm of human error that Tim McGinty, the Cuyahoga County prosecutor, described. How is Cleveland reacting to that characterization of the killing of a 12-year-old boy in a park?
Cleveland, of course, as any city, is a mix of parts. Overall, the public reaction has been actually relatively muted. There was a protest last night, maybe 3 dozen people marching from the place where Tamir Rice was killed over to a police station. Everything kept very peaceful and calm, as have many of the protests that have happened since November 22nd of 2014.
There has been some questioning and criticism of Tim McGinty after he said that he's not bringing charges here, about sort of his justification, saying the grand jury in this case didn't select charges. A lot of people had a problem with that, knowing that prosecutors shape grand juries to indict or not indict. What's the reaction to that?
Well, McGinty did say that he did make a recommendation. He did not see a criminal case here. He saw a tragedy, a human tragedy. And he is very insistent that he went through the review process. He was far more public and transparent about it. And actually, those who criticize him do acknowledge that. In fact, that's one of the point of criticism, is that he was letting out too much information about the grand jury process, trying to steer public opinion even before the grand jury decided. And the family of Tamir Rice says it's very clear that from the get-go, he did not want an indictment. And in the name of transparency, he was trying to build public opinion that way.
Now, you also heard from the deputy prosecutor, Matt Meyer, on that perfect storm of human error that McGinty described. Listen.
The 911 operator never told the dispatcher about the possibility that Tamir was a juvenile or the gun was a toy, which led to the two responding officers to believe that a real man with a real gun was threatening innocent people's lives at a recreation center.
Now, again, ML Schultze, this goes to the argument of the perfect storm of human error, that when officers arrived in that park where 12-year-old Tamir Rice was playing with a toy gun, they didn't have any expectation that he was a kid or that it was a toy.
Yeah, and actually, this is the one place that original 911 caller is the one person who apparently was not part of this perfect storm. He did everything you would want somebody to do. He called the 911. He said, there's a guy with a gun outside the rec center. There are people around. He's getting them nervous. But 3 different times, he qualified it by saying the gun is probably fake. It's probably not real. He also said it's probably a juvenile. So in every way you would want a responsible citizen to handle that kind of call, he did. It's from that point on that things apparently became that perfect storm, because you have a dispatcher who didn't pass on those 2 key pieces of information. And as McGinty said yesterday, the officers raced in with very little time for anything to go in any different direction because they thought the gun was real.
What about when they got to the location, though? Despite the 911 caller, despite the dispatcher, the police have said that they believe that he was much older than he was. He stood at 5'7 and wore 36 size pants, they said, and that they thought that he was an adult, or at least much older than 12.
And the emphasis on the appearance of the boy has become one of the points of criticism of McGinty. It's actually part of a well-documented pattern where when white people see black children, they are often likely to describe them as bigger and scarier than they would describe a white child. And this emphasis on his appearance, there's no question he was large for a 12-year-old, but this emphasis is seen as almost saying, well, that explains it. What other people have raised is, had it been a white child with a gun, regardless of size, would there have been more time for it to have taken a different path?
The people who haven't been here before, this is a discussion of how ball games are related to racism, white supremacy. That's why they are important. Ball games, next to shooting black people, ball games are the most important some of the most important activity.
If you are one of the millions of people who loves football, or if you are one of the millions of people who plans to catch up on the big movies over the Christmas holidays, then you probably have the movie Concussion on your must-see list. The film stars Will Smith as Dr. Bennett Omalu, the forensic pathologist who has done as much as anyone to sound the alarm about the effect of repeated head trauma on football players, effects that have now become part of the national conversation about America's most watched sport. We actually have the real Dr. Bennett Omalu with us now from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Hello, Dr. Omalu, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
The film opens with a very sobering story, the story of the Pittsburgh Steeler, Mike Webster. He was called Iron Mike. When he died of cardiac arrest back in 2002, it made national headlines because here's a guy who had multiple Super Bowl rings, and then at the time of his death, he was living in his truck. He had this history of erratic behavior. He just had a very sad end. So what made you look at his brain?
So when I heard about the story of Mike Webster, his life after retirement, his destitution, I empathized with him. I thought he was suffering from a psychological ailment, that he was obviously misunderstood, just like I was misunderstood because I suffered major depression in medical school. I was expecting his brain to look like dementia pugilistica patient or Alzheimer's disease. But when I opened up his skull, his brain looked normal. I remember that moment very vividly. I was so downcast, totally confused. And I felt I had let down Mike Webster. So I went back and searched the literature. And I never saw any report of something like dementia pugilistica in a football player.
So let me stop you there. You are credited with identifying and describing what we now call CTE, which is chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Tell me, if you would, why it is that this repeated head trauma produces such negative results in human beings.
Okay. Like it said in the movie, hope I'm not giving out too much, Will Smith said, God did not create man to play football. The human brain floats freely inside the human skull. So when you have an impact, the so-called concussive blows cause microscopic injuries in your brain. Over time, after you've sustained hundreds to thousands of these blows, there is permanent brain damage. The brain begins to accumulate abnormal proteins, and it will eventually strangle or kill the cells, like it said in the movie. And sometimes it may take weeks, months, years, decades, sometimes up to 40 years later, and you now begin to manifest with symptoms like mood disorders, major depression, suicidal attempts, disinhibition.
There's a scene in the movie, which has now become famous from the trailer, where you meet with this neurologist who's on the NFL side and you demand that he tell the truth, that you tell the truth about this. But his response is what I want to play, because what he talks about is how important this game is.
Tell the truth.
The truth.
Tell the truth.
The truth is that the NFL is a blessing and a salvation, my friend. We employ hundreds of thousands of people.
we send thousands and thousands of poor kids to school. The ownership of this football club has donated millions of dollars to countless charities. Do you want me to go on?
How you feel about that argument?
This movie is not anti-football. It is about our lives as Americans. Whatever you do in life, no matter what your intentions or motivations may be, if you do not accept the truth, because there can only be one truth, you would have problems.
But you really thought that the NFL would welcome your work, that they would be happy to know that you had solved this puzzle. Is that
yes,
true?
Yes, I thought it had a propositional value. It was a product that would enhance football and enhance the lives and the safety and health of the players.
And when did you realize that it wasn't actually going to be that way, and in fact it was going to be the opposite?
I got a call from one of the editors of the journal. I remember that day vividly. The NFL made a very calculated, mean attempt to decapitate me professionally. If your scientific paper is retracted, you are finished in that profession. I could have as well gone back to Nigeria to become a massage therapist.
Did you ever consider retracting it?
No. I had spent hundreds of hours researching this subject, and I had met the families of the sufferers of this disease. They were suffering in silence. They were suffering in obscurity, and it offended my sense of America. I ran away from corruption in Nigeria because my country, Nigeria, is one of the 10 most corrupt countries in the world. To come here, what I was seeing in these players, in my opinion, I thought was un-American.
You must feel vindicated.
I think the players and their families are vindicated. This has never been about me.
Do you feel, though, speaking of the players, that football is doing enough to minimize harm?
Well, I'm not an expert in football or an expert in the NFL. Those are above my pay grade, but I will share with you real-life events and let you make up your mind. In the settlement with the players, I don't know if people are aware, the NFL excluded CTE diagnosis as a justification for settlement.
I think you're referring to the fact that in 2013, the NFL settled a lawsuit with former players.
But they excluded CTE as a qualifying disease for settlement. Okay.
What is the implication
of
that?
Is this an indication of an organization that is taking serious steps about CTE? Let the people watch the movie. In fact, what I challenge us to do as a family, let us all go and watch the movie. Let us all make up our own minds.
Okay. So before we let you go, and thank you, and our congratulations in order, are you pleased with it?
I think Will Smith's acting reaffirms my belief in the American perfection. Will Smith epitomizes that perfection.
How do you feel about his accent?
He did well. In fact, my wife heard it the first time he came to our house. So my wife had her back turned. I think she was going to get something. He started speaking, and my wife turned, said, "Yes, Bennett, what do you want?" And she turned, said, "Excuse me, where's Bennett?"
Did she really?
Yes.
Dr. Bennett Omalu's life and work on brain injuries in football players is the subject of the new film Concussion. Dr. Omalu, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Legendary basketball entertainer Metal Lark Lemon, who grew up in Wilmington, died yesterday in Scottsdale, Arizona. He was 83. WFAE's Greg Collard reports.
Lemon achieved worldwide fame with the Harlem Globetrotters. He was known for his half-court hook shots and trick passes, and he did it all with comedy. Lemon became known as the Clown Prince of Basketball. He was the nucleus of a Globetrotters team that became so big, it had its own cartoon in the 1970s.
Oh, why he calls? Right, girly? I didn't hear anything, Metal Lark. When I say Hawaii calls, you're not supposed to hear anything.
In 2008, Lemon was on WFAE's Charlotte Talks and recalled his first exposure to the Globetrotters as a child in Wilmington.
We would go to the Ritz Theater every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. We would watch 5 cartoons, 3 westerns, and anything else they put on the screen, and the newsreel. And they seemed to make that ball talk. And I took notice, and I said, this is what I want to do.
Lemon was with the Globetrotters for 24 years, from 1954 to 1978. He later formed his own teams and a ministry that traveled to youth basketball camps and prisons. For WFAE News, I'm Greg Collard.
What was it like to be the only black family growing up in Hancock Park?
We had a couple of incidents where people put firecrackers in our rose bushes, burnt crosses on our lawn.
Wow.
That wasn't cute.
The singer Natalie Cole, the daughter of Nat King Cole, has died. Her family said in a statement today, "Our beloved mother and sister will be greatly missed and remain unforgettable in our hearts forever."
It's very clean.
I'm joined now by Jason King. He's NPR Music's R&B expert. Hey there, Jason.
Hi, Audie.
So as we've been hearing throughout the day, Natalie Cole passed away in Los Angeles. She was 65, and she was really a part of jazz royalty, not just her dad.
Yeah, and I would say not just even jazz royalty. I mean, she was part of the black pop tradition that goes back many, many years. But she came through her father and, of course, was connected to him, met so many great long-standing figures in popular music through him at home. They would come over and visit and so on. So she got to know popular music in a really interior way. And then she herself became this star in the 1970s, but in R&B.
Right. Her first album came when she was 25. This came in 1975. And she had a really big single, which I remember still dancing to, which is "This Will Be an Everlasting Love."
This will be.
Jason King, tell us about her early career.
Well, in the 1970s, everybody wanted to be Aretha Franklin, but nobody was exactly Aretha Franklin. Franklin won almost every Grammy you could imagine. She kept winning the Best Female R&B Vocal year after year. Nobody could dethrone her. And it wasn't until 1975 when Natalie Cole comes along with the Inseparable album, with the hit This Will Be, among other hits, that she takes the Grammy for Best Female R&B Vocal. And that's the first time in, I think, 8 years that Aretha Franklin doesn't receive that award. And Natalie Cole really does ascend to this position of being one of the most sought-after R&B vocalists of her time.
Right. She's got these Grammys, a platinum album, and then her career begins to suffer in the 80s. And this is when, and she's written about this in more than one memoir, about her problems with hard drugs and alcohol and that she had to go to rehab twice. Here's Natalie Cole speaking to NPR in 2006 about this.
I think probably one of the most difficult things that can happen to you when you're dealing either with an addiction or a depression, the hardest thing to do is to go out and sing music or to play music or to create music. I think it was just really difficult. I found myself in just too much of a dark place to want to be creative.
And yet she did, right? Jason King, how did she bounce back from that?
Sure. In the late 80s, she started to have hits again. She recorded the song Pink Cadillac, which was a big hit, I think, in 1988.
I love you for your pink Cadillac.
And then she had a huge comeback in 1991 with the album Unforgettable with Love, which was basically a jazz turn for her. But they were using technology so that she could actually record with her father, Nat Cole, who passed away in the late 1960s. So it was this really interesting kind of reconciliation moment of Natalie Cole, the daughter of pop royalty, singing with her father in this really touching and sentimental way.
Unforgettable, that's what you are. Unforgettable, though near or far.
She actually spoke to Weekend Edition Saturday about that in 2013.
It was very, very difficult, very hard for me, because I'd never had the chance to really spend time working with him. The Unforgettable record was done in tribute to my dad. It was my way of saying goodbye, because when he passed away, I was in school, actually on the East Coast, in boarding school when he passed.
That's why, darling, it's incredible.
Jason King, Unforgettable, obviously, it was such a big song, and people so tie her to her father. But how will you remember Natalie Cole? I mean, is there a song for you that really encapsulates her work?
I look at Natalie Cole as one of the great R&B singers of the last 40 years. I think the legacy of hits that she's had is a testament to that. One of my favorite tracks from her is from her live album from the late 1970s, and it's a song that was very popular for her in the live arena. It's called I'm Catching Hell. And the reason I love it so much is because it shows the incredible range that she had and the ability to soulfully dig deep into a song. But it's also autobiographical, and I think it was about the trials and tribulations that she was going through at the time.
It says, if I had the second chance, oh, I'd do it a whole lot different. How many of us can say that tonight? Oh, yeah.
Jason, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Audie.
I'm catching hell.
That was music writer and producer Jason King remembering Natalie Cole. Cole died yesterday at the age of 65.
Alone, that you mean so much to me.
All you have to do is say, I understand racism, white supremacy. I understand what it has done to black people. I'm going to make my contribution to helping black people become an instrument of producing justice on this planet and becoming an instrument through maximizing and developing black self-respect. See, self-respect is the most powerful thing on the planet. There are no nuclear weapons that are more powerful than self-respect. Self-respect plus will plus determination will transform any of the people that we look at and we say, well, these are, you know, great people, the people who have gone before, who have made significant contributions. It's because self-respect plus the will to keep on even though they are threatened with death. People like Martin Luther King, people like Malcolm X, and the thousands of others, Medgar Evers, all of the people who worked and sacrificed, or, you know, who worked and did not mind giving their lives for the cause of justice. So, you know, whatever I can say, do not despair. Do not despair. Go and look in the mirror and decide, I'm going to value myself as a black person, and I'm going to treat myself with respect, and I'm going to treat other black people with respect.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 2nd, 2015. So I have been told. Tough day, but racism, white supremacy, white people, they do not take breaks. But their victims, black people, to grieve. We continue on our assignment. Compensatory call-in. Folks would like to dial in, share your thoughts. Certainly, I'm sure we'll have a host of folks who have remembrances and things that they would like to share about the late Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. We will certainly make ample time for people to do so. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Before I get to the phone line, I know lots of folks just from messages that I've got over the last 24 hours, early 48 hours, I think Thursday when we were on the air, and I literally found out that Dr. Welsing had been hospitalized while we were broadcasting with the 2015 review, and all the different people all over the world that she, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, impacted with her work, dedicating nearly a half century of her life to teaching about, explaining what white supremacy racism is and how it works. So many people touched by her work on the just sterling example that she set of someone demonstrating black self-respect. No, it was tough for me, even getting up this morning. I'm on the West Coast, so we're 3 hours behind everybody on the East Coast. Dr. Welsing, she was hospitalized in Washington, D.C., so when I woke up this morning, I think roughly 8 a.m. my time, 8 a.m. Pacific, literally, like, that was the first thing that I saw as I was waking up, getting out of bed. Dr. Niana Rasayan, who's also been a guest on the program many times, he's done lectures with Dr. Welsing, where he informed me that she had transitioned early this morning. So that was definitely tough to wake up to, and then to labor to try to organize to do the program. But I remembered the words that I played right at the end of the sound clip, and that's from 2011. She was on the program after the execution of Troy Davis, and she's, be not discouraged, be not discouraged. And I particularly think with Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, she left so much material. That would be one thing for all of the people that I know she touched. And just, you know, I can speak for myself, being that we are in a system of white supremacy, white terrorism. To be confused about that for so long and to not have clarity about that and to not have a comprehensive, in-depth understanding of how that has manifested in my life, our lives, and how that is manifested in just things that we see on a daily basis, and to be able to have her come in and, you know, just provide clarity about that so that you understand. I mean, just that alone is just astronomical, and for certainly for the writing that she did and writing the ISIS papers and, I mean, so many different people's programs. If you look online over the years, it is amazing. When we talk all the time about, or at least I talk about, not being spectators and being active, if you have an understanding of racism, white supremacy, and to not just sit back with that information, to try to get out and inform and teach and educate as many black people as possible. Man, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, wow, she did a phenomenal job just trying to inform as many people as possible. I mean, she did 30 visits on this program alone. It's just, it is incredible, and I hope that that is one of the many lessons that we will take from her. And again, just to emphasize, she left a lot of information for folks to go through and read and try and learn as much as possible from everything that she left us. And not just learning, but I mean, really, if you really learn, if you really have an in-depth understanding, it is applied in thought, speech, action, emotions. I hope that if Dr. Welsing had an impact on you, if she touched you, if she helped you get a bit of clarity, if she helped you become less confused, and I can speak personally for people that she took some time to talk to or sit with, man, I hope it is demonstrated in our thought, speech, action, emotions, and particularly the way that we demonstrate Black self-respect with ourselves and other Black people, as she said in the clip. I can only say on a personal level, because, you know, she was here, she did 30 visits with us. That is something I tried to share this on the program every time that she visited. That is priceless to have the amount of time for her to be as much as she did. She was so active and still working as a general and child psychiatrist and still going out and doing lectures, speaking engagements in different spots, and being a guest on so many other people's programs. That was something that I always appreciated. Even, and I mean, at times doing programs at the drop of a dime, and I mean that literally. The sound clip that I played just 2 days ago, where she was commenting on the Charleston shooting, I frequently have insomnia. I did not sleep well June 17th, the day of the Charleston white terrorist assault. I was up all night long, and I was up that morning. I still hadn't gone to sleep. I was awake. I think President Obama was speaking. This was like early morning Pacific time. And I called Dr. Welsing just on a whim to see, you know, she was paying attention to all this, if she had any thoughts. I called her. She was watching the same thing I was, hearing what President Obama was saying about all this. And, you know, we were just kind of discussing, and I just thought, hey, let's see if she'd be down to come on the program. And she, no hesitation at all. Absolutely. Let's do it. Let's do it today. Just she was on the day after the Charleston shooting. She was on the day after the Troy Davis execution. Just so many pivotal events over the years that we've been on, where she was just super generous with her time and expertise to come and hang out with us. Anybody, if you have listened to The Cows, I hope that, you know, man, that is appreciated. Share if you're around Black people and they're more interested in knowing who she was, people talking about Dr. Welsing and talking about what a loss this is. Share some of those programs, because she talked about, you know, pretty much everything that I can think of significance over the past few years since we've been on the air. I can say from also just from a personal standpoint, in terms of how she influenced this program, not just with the work that she did on the ISIS papers and coming to be a guest, but back in 2009, we had just started out. I think we had done 5 programs. Dr. Welsing was number 2. that also should be in for the record. We're closing in on 1,500 programs. Dr. Frances Quest Welsing, number 2, second program that we did. At any rate, I spoke with her a few weeks after she had been a guest on the program, and I was talking about the White Privilege Conference and Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., Black male, who's the founder of the conference, and telling her that, you know, he was in a sexual arrangement with this white woman, this racist, now married to her. And I was telling her about all this, and she said, "You got to get him on the program." And I was like, "Nah, I don't want to do it. I don't want to get into, you know, sort of argument. I really try to stay away from conflict with other Black people. I don't want to do it." And she said, "No, you have got to do that. Black people need to know this, that they, you know, are going out and promoting all this, and this is getting all this publicity. Like, this is really something great, and this is really working against racism. Black people need to know this, and this is not about conflict. You're not having them on to have an argument, but I mean, just that's something that should be public knowledge. Black people should know that, and then any questions that you want to ask around that." And I mean, it took some convincing. I mean, you've heard her. I mean, she is the epitome of class, but I mean, she was insistent, like, "You have got to do it. You can do it. You can be professional." I didn't say argue at him. I didn't say curse him out or anything like that, but you have got to do it. And I have to say, she was correct 1,000 times over. Hugely important program, and a lot of things happened just on the basis of that program. Me eventually going to the White Privilege Conference, him coming back on the program, just huge things happened on that. And that happened repeatedly throughout the year. She was just incredible in being that kind about, you know, sharing information and all the wealth of knowledge she accumulated over the years and sharing that and giving her thoughts and guests that that she thought we should try to get on the program. Norm Stamper being one, questions to ask particular guests. She was just really amazing in that regard. And I can quote Dr. John Henrik Clark, the documentary where he talks about the relationship that he had with Minister Malcolm, where he said that we had a relationship that was fundamentally about information, that Minister Malcolm had such a deep appreciation for information and the knowledge that Dr. Clark had and shared with him that helped him bolster and become stronger in his arguments about white supremacy, racism. I can say the exact same thing. We had a relationship that was about information. Actually, she literally just within the last 10 days, she mailed me the cover of her publication that was before the ISIS papers, The Crest Theory of Color Confrontation, because she had talked about on this program, she talked about how the ISIS flag is, it looks almost identical to the image that she had on the front of that publication. And she, I mean, she just mailed it to me. I pulled it back out today just to look at it and show somebody else. But I mean, totally. And I would say particularly over the last couple of years, like she had people that called her from all over the world. I was just another random, you know, black dude stumbling, confused, trying to find my way. But over the years and her being on the program so many times, I think she just, you know, remembered my voice like, oh, this is that, you know, wacky dude up in Washington State. But just allowing me to give her a ring. If I found something, I would try to keep an eye out for different information, things that I found that I thought she would want to know about, or sometimes just things I was curious to hear her take on. And she was just never interrupted. Even if she was doing something, it would just be just give me 10 minutes and call me right back. Make sure you do. But she was just, man, incredible illustration. If I could underline boldface print, incredible illustration of black self-respect and really dedicating her life energy to doing everything that she possibly could to help other black people, both in her professional work as a psychiatrist and just taking time to share her views and understanding of racism, white supremacy to aid black people. Just a sterling illustration, a huge loss. And again, I can only emphasize, racists, white people do not pause for black grief. If anything, they're looking to heap more of it on. My recommendation, again, if you care about Dr. Welsing, she meant something to you. Her teachings, what she shared, particularly folks who got to go to the Welsing Institute, if you got to meet her on a personal basis, man, manifest it, display it in your thought, speech, actions, emotions, particularly the black self-respect that you demonstrate yourself and that you demonstrate towards other black people. We will definitely make time to get thoughts, not just from people today, but Dr. Rasayan, Pam, I talked to her today as well. To just kind of get their thoughts, remembrances, and how Dr. Welsing impacted the work that they're doing. We'll definitely make time to do that over the program, over the next, you know, few days, weeks, months, long as it takes, really, because I know so many people would have things that they would want to say and share about Dr. Welsing. So we'll definitely make time to do that. And for anybody that's new, I know people that just, you know, started listening to the Cows 4 months ago, 5 months ago, 30 times is 30 times. She was on the program 30 times, and I will be sure to post all 30 because I know it, I mean, it's well over 1,300 episodes, so I know it can be difficult to sift through to find everything. I will post all 30 so that you can peruse and go through the archives. I mean, she... She was that generous that she did. There's a four-hour broadcast where she hung in and answered every single question that people dialed in with just last summer. I mean, that in and of itself, amazing demonstration of Black self-respect and the care that she had for other Black people. With that, I will step aside. If folks would like to dial in. The news clips were important as well. That definitely people had asked about that, if I was going to forego the news clips and, you know, just allow folks to share their thoughts on Dr. Welsing or just playing clips from Dr. Welsing and that sort of thing. And Dr. Welsing, I mean, you talk about someone, in my view, who was just an awesome demonstration of someone who is a counter-racist soldier and constantly being on her assignment. That is one thing that I have the highest regard for in terms of Dr. Welsing. She was informed. She would brag about telling that story and saying that she would go to the newsstand, or she went to the newsstand one time to purchase newspapers. She was getting 5 and Dick Gregory was there getting 20. She stayed abreast of the news and applied it to her theory relentlessly. Things happening all over the world and how that fit in, where that fit in terms of her understanding of white genetic annihilation, the system of white supremacy. That's why the clips stayed there. Yes, we can take our moment to grieve an enormous loss, but as I said, white people are not pausing in what they're doing to us. We should still be informed. Dr. Welsing would want us to be informed and on our assignment. That said, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. We will do the same rules. There are a lot of folks who would like to share. If you could be mindful that other people would like to get their comments in, would like to share just in, I won't say concise, but, you know, be mindful about how much time you are taking to share. And if you could share one time and then allow for other people to get their remarks in, things that they would like to say. And then after we get everybody, then if you have other comments that you want to make or things that have come to mind that you would like to share, or even I'm sure today it's a distant second, but if you should have anything that you want to share about what happened in the news clips, that would be good to know as well. But everyone who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. If you could watch the background noise, that would be very, very helpful just to preserve the quality of the audio. If you know that you're in a noisy area, please use your mute button. And even if you're in a quiet area, just if you're, you know, moving around with the phone, that sort of thing, you might have to take a second to say something to somebody. I know a lot of people have children. Just be mindful. We don't want to disrupt the quality of the program. That's it. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, lines should be open. Feel free to share.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, this has been a long day. This is us that. I actually cried today because this woman, Dr. Welsing, I mean, she took the time out when my sister-in-law, Miriam Carey, got killed to just talk to me. And I played it for my family. And what it did for my family to even hear her words was so comforting. I mean, I first encountered her work in about 1991 or 92. Dr. Amos Wilson actually gave me the Press Theory of Color Confrontation. I still have the pamphlet today, and I read it so many times. A few years later, my grandmother actually bought me the ISIS papers, and I still have that till today. And, I mean, I attended a number of lectures that she gave over the years. And just, I mean, she's been on this show over 60 hours on this show. And just what she's demonstrated has taught me so much in terms of being patient with people who are less informed, who are still struggling, as we all are, and having self-respect and discipline. And the fact that she shows so much respect for the work of others, particularly Neely Fuller Jr., who she always mentions in her work. She's an absolute phenomenal giant. I really pray for her family, her students, her patients, her neighbors, those who had a personal connection with her on a day-to-day basis in this time of their loss, you know. But those 80 years that she was on this earth, she did the work, and I'm going to continue to do the work. So I just thank her for all that she's done.
Ashe, Ashe. Other folks can feel free. You should be with us as well. Just, I know her sister had not been well. That's also something to keep in mind as we pray for her family and people that cared about her, her sister's health. I don't have all the details of that at this time, but I know when I spoke to her, and this was within the last 10 to 15 days, that was one of the primary concerns that she had, was the health and well-being of her sister. So people should keep some prayers in mind for the whole Welsing family at this time. Other folks who had comments, you should be with us as well. We'll take the first. Right on.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, the callers, Kyle's family, listeners. I share the previous caller's heavy heart. Yeah, it's a huge loss for black people in general. As you say, Gus, the amount of information in the work that she did, unmatchable. I know in my lifetime, it's unmatchable. Since 2013, I've been listening to the Cows for maybe about 5 or 6 years, but my father died in 2013, and I was horribly depressed, and people kept telling me I needed to go see a therapist. Well, I didn't want to talk to any white people, so I called Dr. Welsing, and she called me back. And she totally understood where I was coming from. I was like, I don't feel like opening up or saying anything to white people because I don't think that they'll, I don't think that they care. I don't care. They're getting paid for it. At least if I talk to a black person, they can have some kind of, you know, understanding, or we can have some sort of relate on some level. And she understood. And while she didn't know any black therapists in New York City, she did tell me where to go to seek help. So that was a really, really, really big thing for me. And again, since 2013, I have been making trips to the Press Welsing Institute at Howard University every December. I went last month, and she spoke about Mr. Trump. That kind of segues into one of the clips. Interestingly enough, she said that, you know, the problem that America is having with Mr. Trump is not what he's saying about necessarily what he's saying or what he's doing, is that he's showing their hand. You know, it's like, you know, we have this system underneath such a control, and we have people really following what we want to do globally, and here you come opening your mouth. So, you know, she spoke about that And also, there's something about repetition. I don't know. I think it was Dr. Clark who talked about how in his books he would say things over and over again. And the reason that he says them over and over again is so that we would get it. And we had heard Dr. Wellston speak many times about a lot of the things that are in her works over and over again. And the thing that I appreciated about that is that each time I would have a new revelation. At her lecture last month, she spoke about the ball games again, about the big black balls and the small white balls. And something clicked in my head. You know, I'm a victim of racism. I don't get things right away. So, and I don't even know if we ever discussed it on the cows, but the big black ball games are violent. There's often physical contact. There's a lot of movement. And with the small white ball games, they're virtually nonviolent. They don't have any physical contact, and there's very little contact between players or anything like that. And interestingly enough, people who classify themselves as white use violence in order to dominate. But in the ball games, it's like a mind trick. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, we're going to use the black balls, and we're going to say that they're the most violent people. But really, it's us that are the most violent people. So I thought that was also very interesting. And another thing that clicked in my head that she spoke about, the power of repetition. There's a reason why our elders say things over and over to us again. It's really so that we get it. The whole white Jesus thing, she talked about, you know, she said, you know, how we are controlled. We are people who are controlled by a God who is not presented to us in our image. And I thought to myself, you know, they use a trinity. You know, they say it's a Father, Son, and it's a Holy Spirit. It's not even a Father, Son, and a Mother. Their trinity is actually God is white, I am white, and I am God. That's their trinity. And that's basically, you know, one of the major ways they use to control us. But in any event, Gus, I sent you, I don't know if you got the email. I know you've been getting tons of emails. I emailed you the last handout that she presented to us that we studied at the Institute. And I have pictures with her, and it's something that I'm leaning on this family to get through. We can all lean on each other. And like you said, the best thing that we can do is ingest this in our thoughts and our speech and our actions continually. And that's all I had. I'll mute my line.
Ashe, I did get your email with the handout from the last Wellsing Institute from December 2015, and I actually have the audio from that the Wellsing Institute 2015, the last one that she did in December. If Danny is cool, because he's been a guest on the program, if Danny is cool, we'll see if we can play that down the road, because it was she was on her game. So, like I said, I mean, Dr. Wellsing was consistently on her assignment. Thomas in New York, were you going to comment?
Absolutely. Once again, hi guys. How's everyone? Thomas Smith in New York. Hope all is well. I predicted that this year would be extremely terrible, and we start off with the death of Dr. Wellsing. I wish her the rest in power. You know, years ago, I went on a mission to find out why white people are racist. And someone gave me, I think it was my uncle or my cousin, he gave me the ISIS papers, and I knew at that point on why. Years later, I typed her name into iTunes, and the cows came up. And, you know, she was a guest on the show, and I downloaded the show and started listening to the cows. She was a beacon of consistency. Over the years, I knew what her answers were going to be before she gave them. You know, it's pretty much standard. Well, her answers were to pretty much anything, and it was so true. She's a goddess, and I always refer to her work, and as I do now, and her commentary on the show when I talk about racism. Can I say some things about the clips, or are we just going to stick to Miss Dr. Wellsing right now, Gus?
Oh, no, it's certain. Dr. Wellsing would want us to be on our assignment. Feel free.
Okay, I hate to gears here, but last night I didn't get a chance to participate in the book study session. And I just wanted to make a very quick reference that no one brought up. They started talking about the slave productivity, the productivity of the slaves, how it increased. And I think it was an act of racism by the writer, not to mention all of the non-mechanical inventions that slaves made to make their jobs easier that led to the higher production that the slave masters got, you know, like a hoe or a rake or a broom or a weed cutter or hedges. So I just thought that was an act of racism. The race in Brazil piece, you know, Brazil racism is a little bit more complicated than here. Here it's pretty clear cut, you know, white dominate everyone that's non-white. However, in Brazil, they have that added classification of a mulatto, which is a fancy word here for white. I mean, that means black. But there, you know, it depends on how you're treated. It determines how you'll be treated by the system. And I feel bad for those people there. I agree with the white supremacists on their assessment of Obama. He's already illegally passed health care and gay marriage. And he did that without the Congress voting for it to go through. That's why I say illegally. And now he's trying to take away people's gun rights. And, you know, I just think that, man, at the end of this year, when he's gone, I'll be so happy, you know, because we keep wondering why the racism intensity has picked up. And I think he's a big fuel to that. I personally like the bigotry from Donald Trump. I think that he's being honest, telling how he feels, and essentially by doing that, he's telling how other white people feel. He's not playing ignorant. He's not talking about white consistency, white privilege. He's consistently made comments that directly show how white people feel. And I think it's important. To me, the fact that he's winning proves that white people are not ignorant. The Slocan massacre, like most race riots, the white riots, I should say, it was done to steal land. Like the people in Tulsa, the people in Slocan owned huge portions of the land, even parts of the lands that the white people lived on. And even though the laws would not allow them to live on those parts of the land, they owned it, and white people had to pay them. And whites used those riots to kill their landlords and to burn the proof that blacks owned that land so they could keep it. You know, usually the first thing they built, like in Slocan, was the office that held all the deeds. Now, that piece where it was 1,100-plus murders, police murders this year, 46 alone in Chicago, 95% of the victims were non-white. And no one got fired, you know. They just wait 5 years and their record's clean in Chicago. And Oklahoma City became the killer cop capital of the country this year. It already was the police raping capital of the country. And, you know, it's just ironic how black people are still talking about voting. They voted for these people to get in the office, and look what's happening. Tamir Rice, you know, to me, it's just enough said, you know, Tamir Rice, no justice. I mean, the only system of racism, only in a system of racism would human ever be excused for blatant murder. This wasn't a car accident, you know, where, you know, you made a mistake or, you know, you had an accident. This was pulling the trigger. The way white people killing black kids are adults, I believe they're lying. White people study blacks, and they know us well. And they could probably guess our age as soon as they see us. And they've been guessing our age since the slave block. And I just don't believe it. RIP also to Natalie Cole. I tell everyone about that story, how her family was treated when they moved to that all-white area. Here you had the biggest singer in the world, the person that gave white people a white Christmas. And I think they killed his dogs. I mean, man, you know white people love dogs. So I wish black entertainers, they did this during that clip, you know, I wish they stopped validating themselves with white awards, even though she didn't do it, but the person in the clip did. I mean, who cares if she was nominated or won a Grammy or American Music Award or an Oscar? No, that's all white validation. Just do what you got to do. And lastly, Gus, remember when we read Malcolm X? Well, you know, we did the book study session on Malcolm X. And at the end, there was a young white girl who went to see him. And he was empathetic toward that white girl.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I remember.
Okay, so it brings me back to that end of the year show where people were talking about, you know, interracial marriage. I don't want to get into Area 8, but the beacon of counter-racism in a lot of people's eyes, Malcolm X. And because of that interracial relationship he had prior, he still had this emotional empathy for this white girl. And that's why I say N-O to that type of relationship. I mean, my line. Thank you.
Right on. All the other folks who dialed in, I shouldn't say everybody. I'm trying to stagger it a little bit just so that I can watch out for background noise. But about half of the people that dialed in with a hand up, line is open, and I'm coming to the other half. Just be patient. I'm going to make sure we get everybody in. Guarantee if you dialed in, you got a hand up, we will make sure that you get your time to make your peace and whatever comments you want to share. The folks that your line is open, feel free.
May I be heard?
Hello.
Let's go the first female that spoke. We'll get you, and then we'll come to the next female.
Okay, good evening. Thank you. I'll try to be quick. Gus, I remember last year you said something about how white people could not change. They're not rehabbable, and I've been pondering that all year, and I've come to the conclusion that you are correct. As far as Dr. Frances Cress Wilson, I've been kind of messed up all day. Her ISIS paper is my foundation book. It's the book that I always go to if I want clarity about something. I think I've listened to all her shows with you. Also, her theory can be applied to every single thing that occurs with races that we see in the news or personally. Also, I attempted to send her book to a young man who's in prison, and he never received the book. So that tells me that they probably banned the ISIS paper in the prisons. I just want to personally thank you for being so great with her. I've heard her on other shows, and I think that you have always been very respectful towards her, and I got the feeling that she enjoyed sharing with the cows, because on other shows she'll cut her speech short, but with your show she took the time to answer each and every question. I think it's very important for us to carry on her work by continuing to reference it anytime that we're able to. And I agree with Thomas Smith. I think this year is going to be horrendous. Last year was terrible, and we're only in day two, and look at all the things that have happened in the past 2 days. I just want to thank you again for having this show. Rest in peace, Dr. Frances Cress Wilson, and I mute my line.
For sure. Appreciate that. There was another female caller. I heard you just a moment ago. Did you have comments you wanted to get in?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
I don't know if it's me or not, but it sounds like you're a little like not clear, Puff. I don't know if you're on if you have an earpiece or how you're communicating, but say something again. Give us another sentence.
Can you hear me now?
That's better. Go ahead.
That's better. Okay, very good. Greetings, everyone. This is Puff. I am very, very hurt, saddened by the loss of Dr. Wilson to the black community. And I want to echo the sentiments that you brought out early in the program, but I also want to highlight one crucial and important like detail of it. This lady did not have to do all of the work that she did. She could have just started off as she was a physician. When she came out of medical school, she could have started a practice, and it would have been the end, and we would have never known who Frances Cress Wilson was. But because Dr. Frances Cress Wilson, was. And so the point of that is, I thank the Lord that she shared everything with the black community, and it shows her deep love and care for the black community to work toward enlightening all of us. Because what she could have done was she could have just put it together in her own mind and just kept it to herself. Or, you know, just started a practice and that's it. And so, you know, there was no monetary need to do all of this work. And so this work was done out of care and deep love that she had for the black community. And I thank the Lord for her work every day, because it gave me a whole nother perspective, like on the whole, like, why is it racist? Like, why don't, I just couldn't internalize all that, you know, and why they were doing it. And then that's why, for white genetic survival. If they didn't do this, then they would disappear. So, you know, her work is a gift that, you know, we can reflect on, and I'm very grateful for that. And go ahead to the next person.
Ashe, ashe. Added more folks to the line as we roll. And I did want to get in really quick as well that piece about the massacre in Slocum, Texas, where they said a minimum of 200 people killed. That segment, it was about a 30-minute interview. And the only reason that I cut it short was because Constance Jawaid, Holly Jawaid, the black female who was the descendant of one of the victims, she was on the program. And E.R. Bills, he's not a suspected racist because he is in a tragic arrangement. He's married to a black female. But he wrote the book on the Slocum massacre. He also was on the program last summer. You can go on the archives. It's last August. They were on the program at the same time. And we talked all about that incident. And again, you can multiply that by at minimum 260. All the folks that have a hand up, where your line is open, if we have not heard from you thus far, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I'll give it to you guys and to all the listeners. This is Ross. And, wow, I'm just shocked today. I'm pretty devastated. And all I could say is please rest in peace. I envision, like, legions and legions of our greatest ancestors waiting to receive her in the world of the dead. She was incredible. I remember the first time I was given her book, I was 16 years old. I was 1989 by my father. And it changed my entire perception of the reality of what white people were. And it still took me a long time to even develop my understanding to this point. But she's pivotal in my understanding of racism and white supremacy. And I'm eternally grateful to her. She should be an inspiration to us. You guys, I would like to say, I don't know if you understand how important this program is, and I give you the utmost thanks and just my humble gratefulness just for having her and all the other people that you've had on this program. Her contributions are they're just unmatchable. I found it very telling that she chose to title her seminal work The ISIS Papers, because ISIS is a very powerful Egyptian goddess, and she was considered the quintessential mother figure. And to me, that's exactly what Dr. Wilson was. She was the mother of the understanding of racism, white supremacy. I don't think anyone else is equipped to even touch her in that realm. And it's just, My voice is shaky because I'm just totally devastated, but I'm so thankful. I think she gives us a lot of inspiration as far as what we have to do to keep her legacy alive and facilitate waking up other black people to the reality of what racism and white supremacy is. And I wanted to also segue into a couple of news events that I think kind of speak to some of the things Dr. Wilson talked about. There was the section where the woman talked about what, being proud of being white trash. And I just found that that was the best description for what white people are and have always been. It made me think of Dr. Kamal Cambon. He has a very brief video on YouTube that's called The Most Serious African in the World, where he discusses the fact that the only niggas on this planet are white people, and that all black people are imitation niggas. And I agree emphatically in that statement that that woman spoke. Speaking to herself in white trash and being proud of it exemplifies everything that she said in that very brief video, but it's very powerful, so I suggest, you know, if people can take a look at it, they do. I saw something else. I saw a news article that stated Boko Haram actually killed more than 17,000 people in 2015. This speaks to Dr. Wilson, and she speaks of black self-respect and us loving one another and not doing the bidding of racist white supremacists. They actually stated in the article, even though ISIS got all the news attention, the people who put in the most work in taking lives, especially black lives, as far as these Islamic militants, was Boko Haram. So I think that gives us a lot of false thought and brings a lot of what Dr. Wilson has discussed over the years full circle as far as our understanding of what we have to do and what kind of work we have to put in. Another article I saw talks about a 9-meter-tall statue of white Jesus that was recently erected in Nigeria. And to me, it's like the greatest expression of white supremacy is they're on a double time roll on the African continent. And we have a lot of work to do to wake up our people to the fact that it was an African, a rich African male who contributed the money to build the statue. And it's the largest statue of its kind on the African continent. Really speaks volumes, and we have a lot of work to do. Dr. Wilson always talked about us working with one another, teaching one another, not judging one another. And that's something that we really should take a lot of take to heart and really try to live those eternal principles. Try our hardest to, like you say, just, you know, speak about it, write about it, blog about it, whatever you have to do to get the word out, you should be inspired to do so. I also thought about the clip you played on the Soka Massacre, and it just really brought home something else that Dr. Wilson talked about, is just the fact that all of these events that we study have been repeated ad infinitum throughout American history, and it just speaks to the fact that this can happen on a mass scale at any time. Exactly what she says happened to the Jews is exactly what they did in Slocum and all the other white riots in which they terrorized black people. And I believe that Hitler got the whole understanding of taking the guns away from the Jews before seeking to slaughter them from early American history, in which they would take guns from Civil War veterans and things of that nature before going on these mass killings of black people. I think we have a lot of waking up to do, and I thank God and the ancestors most of all eternally for just allowing Dr. Wilson's spirit to touch down on this planet and give us the insight to understand the world that we really live in. And I hope that we're all inspired to continue to do her work. Thank you so much.
Other folks that we have not heard from yet, if you all had comments.
Hello?
We can hear you, but you're a little low.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Speak up, use your maximum black self-respect voice.
I want to say, for the passing of Frances Chris Welbring O'Shea, as she transitioned on to another phase in her life, listen to some of the clips. They were speaking about Brazil. And from what I know, Brazil is where the first Africans came before natives came into the United States. There's a book by Dr. David Imhotep called The First Americans Were Africans, Documented Evidence. That's a recent book, I think, maybe in the last couple of years it came out. And the thing that's been interesting to me is how there's been a lot of things spoken about Muslims, but the term that's used is Muslims. And I was looking on the United States Census, and it says it, on the census that it has whites classified as, well, it has Arabs classified as whites. I'm not saying the Arabs are white, but since they're classifying Arabs as whites, it's peculiar that they never use the term Arabs. And the term Muslim keeps being used a lot. And so they always say, and the assumption I assume is that most Muslims are not white. But if they're classifying Arabs as white, then I'd actually have to hear what white people say about that, if they think that Arabs are white. If just a regular white person got asked that question. And I was also wondering if you could try to get Ernie Chambers on the show. He's a legislator in Nebraska. Earlier this year, he got into a little controversy by linking ISIS with the police, just as an analysis of how the police forces interact with Africans. That's all I had to share. Thank you.
I have to check on that, see if I can find some contact information. Ernie Chambers in Nebraska. I'll see if I can do some homework on that. Other folks that we have not heard from, if we have not heard from you and you had comments, feel free.
Hey, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening to you, the host, Gus, and to all the callers. And, you know, I just want to, you know, express my condolences for Dr. Wilson's family and for you, Gus, and the callers and listeners of your show, because those of us who had the opportunity to sit, in the sense, even though we were on the phone when she was on your show, like sitting at her feet, you know, listening and being educated and, you know, being enlightened, it's a member. I wrote on my page this morning when I first heard it, and I wrote, our warrior mother has gone on to be with the ancestors, you know. So I just want to extend condolences not only to her family, you know, her blood siblings and relatives, but also to those of us out here in the diaspora who had the opportunity to read her works, listen to her, sit at her feet and learn. So I just want to give my condolences. But I also just want to say, too, is, you know, I can remember one time she was on your show, and I guess probably within the last, I know this is a new year, 6 months from, say, December, you know, back. And I remember I asked her a question, but I remember I had a question in my head I wanted to ask her, but I just couldn't bring myself to ask her because I guess, because this day came, and I guess this was the day that I didn't want to call for her because I wanted to ask questions because I remember, you know, she's very consistent and insistent in what she was saying. I remember she would say, you know, because I'm the only, you know, psychiatrist who was studying what she was studying. And I was just saying that is so true. And I remember the question I wanted to ask is like, you know, Dr. Wilson, when the day comes that you lay your pencil down, you know, either you retire or like this day comes and you transition, like who picks up that pencil? Who, you know, picks this up and keep going? And I guess say thank you to you, Gus, and even to the other callers. It's like you say, she would want us to be on our assignment. Somebody's going to pick up that assignment who has that spirit of Dr. Francis Cresswelly, because you know it's going to be a lot of naysayers or people that's coming, because, I mean, I've seen some things on Facebook this evening, you know, very unkind things said about, I think this one homosexual guy, I mean, he just put something on me, it was just crazy, but you know they're going to come, and then there will be the people who will come who will want to tear apart her research and use what they want to try to prove what they're trying to prove, you know, and taking it all out of context. So I'm just praying that her spirit, that somebody who is alive and well, walking this earth, that this spirit will come, and they will pick up her work and in her spirit continue on with this, because this is, to me, this is a devastating loss. This is a giant I don't hate to say loss, but a giant who did her assignment, and her assignment came to an end. That's, you know, and the ancestors called her home for rest. But it's nevertheless, it's still devastating. I know I'm devastated, and my heart is very heavy. And I had the opportunity of first hearing about Dr. Wilson. This was back in the mid-'80s when I was living in D.C. And I read her book back then, but actually my mind back then was nowhere near it is now. So I'm going to have to read the book again because of where I'm at now, you know, for better understanding. But I just want to say thank you to you, because of you, I got a chance to really, you know, your show, to sit at her feet, you know, to sit at the feet of a, what I call a warrior mother, and proudly to be called a child of hers, to being educated and being enlightened and taught of the things that that are life-saving and life-sustaining things, you know, to let us know. And I'll just say this, and I'll mute my line. And I was on Facebook and going to YouTube, and I have someone that I sub to, subscribe to his page, and he did like a 10-minute reflection on Dr. Wilson, and he talked about, you know, all the other, say, black women that we know, like the Oprah, you know, Oprah Winfrey, this and that. He says, you know, you didn't hear much of Dr. Wilson, and it's just like, you know, no, you were not going to hear Dr. Wilson. That seemed like after Phil Donahue went off the air, because Phil Donahue did have her on his show, on this program, on his show. But it seemed like after he went off where, you know, we know Oprah Winfrey because of her audience, what she was about in terms of her TV show, was not going to have a Dr. Francis Cress Wilson. So I just made a little comment on his page, and I said, well, the sad thing about it, I said, the masses of black people don't know about a Dr. Francis Cress Wilson, but they know about a Tim Wise. And I told him, I said, that's who they know. They don't know Dr. Wilson, but they know Tim Wise. And that is the pain and shame of this. And the pain and shame of, I think it was somebody earlier said, you know, who she could have been. Yeah, even think one time she said, you know, she could have been out there making long money, just doing, you know, as the sister would want her to do. But, you know, she answered her calling, if you will. She answered and took forth her assignment, and she done it well. So I just wanted to say that, and just again, thank you, and then again to all of us who are mourning this loss. Let us hold up and continue on with the assignment. And I'll read my line. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I would like to just send out my condolences to the family of Dr. Francis Cress Wilson. After learning about, you know, who Dr. Francis Cress Wilson was, and context of white supremacy and Nita Fuller, it kind of changed my mindset about how I interacted with victims of racism. Before, at one time, you know, coming out of confusion, which I'm still am, just the process of me trying to come out of confusion. But in the beginning steps of me trying to come out of confusion, I found myself pointing the finger at other victims of racism, saying, well, I have the key to the knowledge and you don't. I understand white supremacy a little bit better than you do, you know. And after running across Nita Fuller and the Kyle and Dr. Francis Cress Wilson, it kind of helped me understand more about how much I didn't understand. And I'm not going to say that my interactions with victims of racism right now is codified, you know, but it's an everyday struggle for me to try my best to codify my behavior, you know, you know, one, you know, slowing down by people I, you know, engage daily activity with, unless it's constructive. I'm, you know, I'm starting that recently, and I don't do that all the time. But, yeah, I just like to say my heart goes out to the family of Dr. Cress Wilson, Francis Cress Wilson, and losing her is losing an aspect of an opinion from a person that we no longer have. It can just call and say, how do you feel about this subject? Or how do you feel about that subject or this subject? So it just, we have to appreciate the Jews that were here when they were here. And I think you did a good job, Gus, in appreciating her when she was here. And I would also like to end this by also stating my disgust for the racist white supremacist known as Tim Wise. And I'll mute my line.
Ashe. Ashe. If you have a hand up and we have not heard from you, feel free to chime in.
Maybe heard.
I heard both of you. We'll take the female caller first.
Good evening. This is the caller from Detroit. I'll be really brief, but I definitely wanted to give my condolences to the family of Dr. Welsing and to the Kyle's family. I'm forever grateful and thankful for encountering Dr. Welsing. I stumbled across this program and Neely Fuller, Dr. Welsing, in my quest to understand the system, what it is and how it works. And it's amazing that I heard a saying, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And just, you know, randomly in my search, I was, you know, like all of us, fortunate enough to stumble across her work. And Dr. Welsing really demonstrated grace and class and her patience with other Black people, and how she stressed Black self-respect. And, you know, it was just such a shock. I remember, Gus, you talked about, you know, her sister being ill or under the weather, and for us to, you know, pray for her sister. And then when I, you know, all of a sudden heard that, you know, this news, and then now she's transitioned, it just really shows and proved to me how we can't take a day, a minute, an hour, or a second for granted. You know, I'm just, you know, or I know for myself, it's like, oh, you know, we have the archives, or we can just wait for the next time she's on the program. But I'm just so thankful that she was, you know, like you've echoed and other callers have echoed, was so gracious of her time. We have so much information to build on, to understand better how this system works. And I know when I first started my journey to understand the system, my question was why? Like, why is this happening? Why are white people treating us this way? Why? And I got my answer, you know, through reading the ISIS papers and just constantly feeding off of her conversations and act and graciousness to answer our questions on this program. So, again, like everyone has said, I so thank you, Gus, for your consistency and just your time, effort, and energy and giving us this show. I challenge all the callers, all the listeners, and myself to just constantly master patience with other Black people and patience with Black self-respect, and to support programs like this. I spend so much money and waste so much money on things that when I really list things and see where my money goes, I'm so committed to making sure that programs like this exist. I remember last year, Gus, you went off air for some time. I think it was, I don't remember what it was, but I had a serious attitude, like, okay, why, what's going on? And I had to blame myself. I'm like, whatever it is, I haven't done my part to step up to make sure that the program exists. So again, you know, I just want to take full responsibility and accountability on making sure that I do my part in helping other victims become less confused, and it's platforms like this that will allow us to do that. Our work is not done. She left us instructions. You know, we try to complicate it. We make it so hard, but when I listen to her over and over again, Black self-respect, Black self-respect, Black self-respect, and I'm going to work on that so much more. And again, I thank you. I do have tons of notes from other clips, but right now my heart is just not leading me to discuss the clips. If we do have a place for workplace racism, I may chime back in, but I just want to say thank you. And I also want to thank all the other callers who chime in every week. There may be people who may not understand how significant your comments are, but I thank everybody for chiming in every week because it helps. It helps. So I'll mute myself, and I just want to share that.
Right on, right on. There was a male caller who spoke up the same time our female caller in Detroit did. Were you going to comment as well, sir?
Greetings.
Greetings.
Hey, Gus. Long time. This is your Ross caller.
Oh, greetings. Greetings. Good to hear from you, sir.
Yeah, you too. Yeah, it's no coincidence. The first time I called in your program was Francis Chris Wilson interview. I think in 2011. But I just wanted to, I'll just keep it short, like everybody pretty much, you know, echoing everyone else's sentiment, like, you know, if she showed us anything, then it was consistency and just how to stand up, you know, how to literally, like, stand up. Like, I can't even really think of her sitting down during, like, one of her lectures or, you know, just lengthy. I mean, we can't see her during the phone interviews, but, you know, just literally as, you know, a person who stands up and just, you know, self-respect. So, you know, I just kind of feel like at this point, all we can really do is just do what she did and, like, you know, lead by making an excellent example. And I'll just leave it there.
Good to hear from you again, sir. Other folks who have a hand up, if we have not heard from you, feel free. If you have a hand up and we have not heard from you yet.
Can I be heard now?
Oh, yes, sir. We got you. We got you.
Yes. Greetings, everyone. Yes, I've been, of course, reflecting recently about Dr. Welsing, and when I think about her, I think about the dedication. The first thing I think about is the dedication that she applied to in working with Mr. Fuller and another physician that she says that it took about a decade to finalize what we know as the code book, which requires a lot of patience, and you sense that in her when she's talking to other people, as well as in front of audiences. You never hear her voice waver to something that can be considered to be anger. It's even toned, and therefore it gives maximum level of the opportunity for a list for a person to really grasp on what that person is talking about. My first encounters with her was with her book. It's even before I even know anything about Mr. Fuller, other than a soundbite, if you will, in her book. To quote him by saying, if you don't understand the system of race and white supremacy, what it is and how it works, everything else that you do understand would only confuse you. That's the only thing I knew about Mr. Fuller. When I read the ICE papers first, and I have it right in front of me, and it actually is the most beat-up book that I have in my library from using it, referencing it from time to time, going back to it. And as I mentioned, the amount of years of dedication and consistency she has is certainly an example to all of us on what one should attempt to do and to attempt to be functioning as a counter-racist individual. I really don't feel like mourning, because it's she, what she meant to me is so positive. It's so positive. I just don't feel like being, you know, sad as far as the feeling. I mean, of course, you're gonna miss that person. But the tons of information, and also from the standpoint, my understanding of victims of the system of racism, white supremacy, is to, as quickly as possible, get it and be able to understand the logic themselves, to be able to move forward. So in that, and what she was, in my opinion, successfully inputting, I'm going to continue to move forward and spread the word about the war that white people has been and are waging against us, so we can effectively learn to counter their behavior and moves and replace it with a system of justice. Thank you.
Ashe. We miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up that we have not got to? Anybody have a hand up that we have not got to or heard from? Let's
see. Hello?
Greetings.
Hey, greetings. Hey, man, this is my first time ever getting on here, so y'all excuse me. But, you know, on another note, I actually was watching Miss Wilson on the Donahue thing on YouTube the other day. I done watched it about 10 times, right? But, you know, she do talk a lot about self-respect. And I just noticed, like, how she, when she was dealing with the white man, you know, she was real, she deal with them real good. And, like, they couldn't really deal with her, so he played games. You could see, like, how everything come out of his mouth, he tried to make it be a joke, you know. Like, she crazy, then got all the white people in the audience, but she just dealt with them, you know, she dealt with them real good. And, I always look at it like, yeah, this lady here, you know, she got, you know, good respect for herself, you know. And then the other thing I wanted to share, on the 4th of July, police took me to jail. I had the book in my backpack, right? You know, this to talk about what she was saying about the cover. So when I get out of jail, my book gone. So I'm trying to track the book down. They telling me the book that the police took me to jail, he got the book, he confiscated. So I go to the police station the next week, And I get the book back. Now, they done had the book for a few days, right? So then about 10 days after that, I'm at the library on the computer, right, checking email. And Homeland Security, the people from the Homeland Security coming in, grab me up, take my aside, and they asked me about the book, right? Talking about, but I ain't have it on me then. So they asked me about the book. And, man, I'm saying, when I went to telling him what the book was about, you know, about the genetic annihilation and the genetic inferiority. Man, it was like them people wanted to kill me, but they ain't do nothing to me, you know. But that was just to touch on what you were saying about the cover of the book. So there is, like, people with the book, they trying to, you know, put you in the category as, like, a terrorist now. So, you know, Homeland Security, they running up on people by the book and everything like that. And that's all I got to say, man. I've been listening for a long time, man. I'm just now figuring out how to get involved with it. So, but yeah, man, I appreciate everything and everything what people be talking about. Because, you know, I'm feeling like, hey, man, if it could touch me and wake me up and get me to move and start trying to think a little better, you know, sure, there might be a chance for, you know, a whole lot of people to wake up and, you know, put something together, man. You know, so that's it, man. You can cut me off.
Ashe, appreciate that. I'm glad that you shared that, all of it, really, particularly them confiscating the book when they detained you, and then Homeland Security coming to interrogate you. That's what she mailed me. She emphasized that when I spoke with her, not the last time, but I spoke with her in December, and she heavily emphasized that. She had said it on the program before, and I think she emphasized it when she was at the Welsing Institute in December, that she did not, and she had been saying this for a long time, she did not think it was a coincidence that this group, that they're spending all this time and angst, and oh my gosh, this is the worst threat in the history of the universe, is named ISIS, matching her her work, the ISIS papers and the Keys to the Colors. But she emphasized that. She emphasized the flag that they, you know, allege this is the ISIS flag, that looks exactly like the artwork that she had on her book. And I would strongly advise everybody who, you know, has talked about how much Dr. Welsing, her scholarship and just the patience and care that she devoted to Black people over many, many years. Man, that is something that I would encourage folks to be extremely high alert in terms of watching the way that her work is discussed. Particularly, I would say now that she's deceased, it would not surprise me at all if racists really intensify. Like, oh, man, this is some terrorist work. Who is this Dr. Welsing? And even just looking online, I told her when I spoke with her in December, I just searched ISIS papers. On the first page, about half of the hits were to her and the other half were to this terrorist organization. Just paying attention to how that evolves now that she has transitioned. Definitely, that's something that we're going to have to be very, very alert about, and even probably with some other Black people, because if they see you referencing her work, if you put it in a paper, if you have the book and say, oh, my gosh, what is this? Are you some... Be extremely serious and extremely mindful, because I'm certain it's going to be a lot more of that as we proceed now that she's transitioned. Racists, they go really hard once Black people who devoted their life, their time and energy to working against racism, once they transition, oh man, it's time to do everything we can to besmirch, cover up, hide, and distort their work and legacy. I would definitely encourage us to be on our assignment with regards to that as well. And thank you for sharing that, first time caller. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had a hand up, other folks who have a hand up, if we haven't heard from you yet.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Peace out, all the callers on the line. And I just want to start by saying for Miss Frances Cress Wells, and real quick, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim,
Medikiyo Medin, Yakana Buduai, Yakana Sain, Edina Surat al Mustakin, Surat al Adina Anamta Alehim, Kairu Magdubi Alehim, Wala Darlin. And in English, that just means, in the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, Master of the Day of Judgment. Only thee do we worship, and thine aid do we seek. Show us the straight path, the path which thou hast bestowed with grace, not the path which thou hast bestowed with wrath. And I would like to speak about what she wrote on page 169 of the ISIS papers, which says, the destruction spawned by the unconscious logic implant, God is a white man. However, no matter what the level of initial trauma felt when this logic circuit is brought to conscious awareness, it must be yanked out. Indeed, there can be no mental health, self-respect, or positive self-concept for black or other non-white people as long as this specious and destructive logic circuit remains in place, and that's on page 169. And really, I just did that. You know, I wish that, you know, Allah or God, as people would refer to it in their language or whatever, would grant Francis Cress Wells into heaven, into paradise, into peace. May she rest in peace. May she rest in salam. And I definitely would like to see this cover that she has for the book originally, or the article originally, which allegedly, you know, looked like the ISIS flag or whatever, alleged terrorist group. And also, I would just like to say that, you know, it was very heartwarming to actually speak to this woman on this program. You know, however, you know, insignificant, you know, people may think that it is, it means something to us, and it very well helped me talk to someone that, you know, that I can say helped a lot of people. And, you know, I just want to say that, you know, being a Muslim or a black Muslim, and then also having the teachings of the ISIS papers, I can't even start to explain, you know, the coincidences and, you know, the visions that I have based upon putting the two together. However crazy that may seem in this day and era, you know, taking the Quran, being a black person, and then also having the ISIS papers readily available, that definitely, you know, I can't even start to explain that, but I'm very humble to that information being brought down, you know, by Allah through her, or God through her. And, you know, I would just like to say that, you know, she did show a lot of belief or knowledge, to have some type of knowledge that she believed in God. You know, and I know we like to get off of the area of religion and we want to throw that in the trash can, and, you know, it may not be useful or whatever, but, you know, I'm not using this time to promote that area, but it seems like all at once it comes into play anyway. And a lot of people going to mention the Lord, and a lot of people going to mention God. And, you know, I prefer we mention Allah, but at the same time, you know, black self-respect was the constant thing that I see that Francis Cress Wells can help me gain, and that can help me, from my position, promote black self-respect from my point of view to help those who I can. And I just see her being a warrior scholar, and she was definitely blessed. And I appreciate the time today on the platform of Context of White Supremacy to express gratitude and humbleness to Francis Cress Wells and the ISIS papers. And, you know, may Allah give her paradise, and may Allah bless everyone and the listeners and bring guidance and knowledge to us through whatever mysterious way possible.
Ashe. Ashe. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up and we have not heard from you, you had comments you wanted to get in, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Gus. A long-time listener. I've been listening to you for many, many years. And thank you for sharing Dr. Francis's comments to you concerning ISIS. That's something definitely that I will be more aware of going forward. I'm just glad to have had the opportunity to listen to her. I think I probably have every broadcast that she's been on your show downloaded to my MP3 player. I thank Kyle for that. I'm glad that in my lifetime that I was able to transition to understand her work more. I read her work when I was a young man in the 90s, and as she used to say, you know, people thought she was a mad woman when they first read it. And I'm just thankful that life and life's experience and exposure allowed me to appreciate her work more over the last 7 to 10 years, and particularly hearing her voice, hearing her consistency. I think we all will miss that. Dr. Francis was always consistent in her message, and we could all learn a valuable lesson from her in that, being serious and being consistent with what we preach. And I said, I appreciate your show. I appreciate, again, the opportunity, man, that the college test presented, because I don't think I would have been exposed to her work as much as I have been over 30-something guest appearances on this show had it not been for the college. I've learned to appreciate her. That appreciation will last for the rest of my life, sure the lives of others, just by the fact that I've been able to hear her voice. I probably would have never interacted with her via questions had this platform not been available. So she is missed, but I am, again, thankful that I was able to transition and understand and appreciate her work very much. And it's definitely one of those books that it doesn't sit on my shelf in my library. It just sits on my desk as a ready reference. So I just appreciate her work. Her voice will definitely be missed, but her message will always be here. And that's it.
Ashe. Ashe. I know that other folks, if you have a hand up, I got you. I just wanted to say quickly, I think for a lot of people, people wrote in or shared that, you know, sometimes they felt nervous or felt a bit intimidated speaking to Dr. Wellesen, to call in to ask her a question live on the air or to call her and speak with her. For some people felt that. I know I felt that back in 2009. I think and this was after she had been a guest on the program, but I called her when I was calling to talk about the White Privilege Conference. At this time, I did not have like her personal number, so I just had to call like everybody else. I had to call the office line. And I'm accustomed to it going to voicemail, which it did like 90% of the time. However, there would be times where she would just pick up. And I remember just standing there and I'm waiting for the voice to be like, yeah, I can't believe this. The guy that is doing the White Privilege called this black guy and he's with a white woman. I can't believe this. And so I'm just sitting here waiting to leave my message. And I think somebody had said something. So I'm like in person, somebody that's in front of me. And I was like, yeah, I'm just trying to leave a message for Dr. Wellesen. And she picked up the phone and I was like, and it kind of took me a minute to get things together. Like, okay, this is what I was trying to say, but I can relate. I can only say for anybody, because I've heard people who have kind of said the same thing about Mr. Fuller and a lot of other folks, Dr. Marimba Ani, Dr. Kanban, anybody, you know, that you have some regard for the work that they've done and, you know, they've been helpful for you getting some clarity about the problems we face, the problem being whites. But just, you know, encourage you to step up and ask your question, to not be intimidated, to not be afraid, to just go ahead. And if you have a question, if you have something that you want to ask, or even if it's just sharing an observation, not necessarily a question, but just an observation and something that you want to get out, to not be afraid, to not be intimidated, to be courageous. I didn't even know about Dr. Welsing, there being any medical problems or anything. I knew I wanted to end the 2015 year in review with her comments about Charleston, because I thought they were so important. It just turned out, you know, all of this. But I mean, I had already made that decision when I thought, you know, she was fine and in great health and out doing her work. But just when I went back and listened to it Wednesday, and her opening remarks on the Charleston shooting. And again, this was the day after. This is June 18th, the day after the white supremacist terrorist attack that took 9 lives. Her opening remarks were that she was watching television, like all of us, and her seeing the images of black people and white people holding hands at the church, and, you know, saying we're mourning and this is so terrible. She said she was nauseated. Just that alone. And then she went on to explain in the archives. You can check it out, June 18th. But just having the courage to be accurate and honest about racism. Dr. Welsing, another sterling example, and something that I hope has been reflected over the years on this program, particularly demonstrating the courage to speak accurately and honestly with white people and questioning white people and challenging them when you think they are not being truthful. I think Dr. Welsing, I think her time on the Donahue Show and the debate that she had with William Shockley, people cited that. I think that is hugely important, and again, something that we should be trying to preserve and reflect in our own behavior. But again, do not be afraid about, you know, calling to ask a question, make an observation, to raise your voice. I think has already been touched on. You do not know if you will have another opportunity to get that question in and get that observation in, to go ahead and be courageous. I think Dr. Frances Cress Welsing was a phenomenal illustration of black courage as well. Anybody that we have not heard from, if you had a hand up and we have not heard from you, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, I'm kind of embarrassed to say this, but it's unfortunately, unlike your callers and yourself, I've only come across Dr. Welsing and Neely Fuller's work only fairly recently, but I've always come across her work in sort of passing and people speaking about her, and I just started reading, listening to on YouTube. I haven't finished it. Her talk on Black Love as a Revolutionary Act. But one of the things that stands out to me is that I hear the right things from the right people, i.e. meaning not a lot of white people speaking about her. So that's a good thing. But from what I've heard, I can definitely tell she was amazingly committed to counter-racism. I think the evidence is pretty clear to me. And I hope that there are others willing to take that, who will continue to pick up the assignment, as one caller said, especially if they come over to Toronto, because you know how I think about the way we discuss racism in Toronto. And the other thing that stuck out to me is what one of the callers said. You know, it's unfortunate that, you know, we're very familiar with someone like a Beyonce or an Oprah who, you know, I know, you know, black people, we have our confusion, but it's unfortunate, you know, folks like that more so than we know a Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, who actually does productive work for black people specifically. And of course, she wouldn't be on a show like Oprah, who unfortunately is, you know, individual achievements aside, is going to cater to a middle-aged white female audience. Unfortunately, it's what it is. And regarding the clips, I know what I like what one of your other callers was saying about Trump just showing how racist white people are. Like, I always try to explain to people that Trump, and we had a very similar situation in Toronto, Rob Ford, a mayoral candidate, who was mayor, and he was very similar to Trump, except the only difference I would say, he was very skilled in actually confusing the black people in Toronto, specifically the Jamaican descended peoples. Definitely someone you want to Google. And, you know, people used to see him as, you know, an aberration, but I would say that, no, he reflects the way Canadians, white Canadians, really think about black people. Donald Trump is American. He's what white people think. And I think that's where people have to start to understand that he is the actual norm of what whites say to you, either straight up, like some do, or what they say behind closed doors. That's why he's getting the support, and I think that needs to be emphasized, that he's not just some, you know, out of black white person. I think it's especially important. That's another thing in that clip. I don't know which one, if it was two clips or which one, where the speaker kept referring to bigotry. I find that an act of racism, white supremacy, when we just speak of it as bigotry or prejudice, when we don't just say white supremacy or even at least racism. We should be able to say racism. I don't like when they say bigotry or especially ethnicity. I find those words very distracting and confusing. The other thing now about Natalie Cole, another great example of John Henryism, and I think one of your callers mentioned this earlier about white validation, and, you know, I was speaking to my father about this today, about Natalie Cole and Nat Cole and some of the things jazz musicians went through, the kinds of John Henryism they had to basically deal with. And I think him fighting to stay and live in Beverly Hills, while very admirable in terms of courage, I think it goes back to this very problem of white validation, why we need these Oscars and Grammys. They don't know anything. And I think we should also think about that when we're moving into places, like I was saying, my father, we should think of black people here, should think about how they actually move. Like, why should we have to fight to be in a white neighborhood just for people who hate us, right? Why should we keep seeking to integrate with them, have them in our school, go to school with them, when, you know, they do nothing for us? They're going to be white supremacists. They're all the same one way or another. And this need for white validation, the Natalie Cole situation is a perfect example. We should not seek to be near white people. We should try to minimize our contact with white people as much as we can. And I think the Cole situation is a good example, because I always think about it. Imagine if that was us, instead of fighting to be in that neighborhood, they fight to actually go away from it. That's just something that stood out to me. I'll mute my line. Those are all my thoughts.
Right on. Before I nab the other callers, I just wanted to say real quick, there's a great documentary, and I mean like A+, on Nat King Cole and the whole Cole family, and it's centered around the white supremacy that they endured. But I think Thomas in New York already pointed, they killed their dog, burned nigger into their yard, it's just terrorism. And I wrote on Facebook, terrorism has health consequences. Who's Afraid of the Dark? That's the name of the documentary. You should be able to get it online or check it out. I think it's a BBC documentary, but it's phenomenal. Anybody that we have not heard from should be with us.
Can I be heard? Is it too late?
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to, I tried to get off work early so I can comment on the commentary, the clip. What I noticed in the clip that you played, even the ones, what is that, the end of the year, 31st or whatever, last month, everything is basically the same when they're speaking about black people. Just in all of the clips, when they're speaking about black people, they're very cautious of how they word the terrorism that they inflict on us versus when they're trying to, when they're speaking of terrorizing other people, they use, like, different wordings. It's racism or, what is it, bigotry or something like that when they're speaking of non-white, non-black people. But when it comes to us, it's they don't use those same wordings. It's just like we're making a big deal out of it or we're jumping to conclusions. But when it's someone else, especially with the, I guess this, election, because this is election time and everyone's, you know, going for the gold, they still use these particular words when they're talking about how they are with non-white people, but only with black people are they very specific when it comes to making sure they don't say racism, white supremacy, nothing like that. But when it's used with other nationalities, they want us to, oh, racism. So that's what I noticed with all of the clips. And I, since we're talking about Dr. Francis Cress Wilson, I will do my part in following her work and just all the stuff that we've done throughout the years with her and all the other guests, and just the readings and all that, because I was a little thrown back because I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready for any of this, but since it's here, I'll do my part because she was great, and my son feels some kind of way because even with, as he's gotten older and he can respect and appreciate her and her work, he was kind of taken back because everything just happened. It was just so quick. It's like, bam, 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 it's like, oh. So thank you for allowing me to speak, and I'll stop.
Ashe, ashe. Anybody with a hand up that we have not heard from? Anybody that we have not heard from?
Okay, I would like to, this is Sunny from L.A.
Greetings.
Greetings. I would like to read something briefly. It's brief, but it's what I feel. And it is something that I was written by someone else. I've modified it a bit, but it fits for me. And it's short for Dr. Wellesley. Of courage undaunted, possessing a firmness and perseverance of purpose which nothing but impossibilities could divert. From her direction, careful as a teacher of those committed to her charge, yet steady in the maintenance of order and discipline, intimate with the character and customs and principles and history of black people, habituated to the commitment to her life call, guarded by exact observation of the system of racism, white supremacy, and familiar with her own country, therefore against losing time in the descriptions of objects and theories already possessed, honest, disinterested, liberal, patient of sound understanding, and a fidelity to truth so scrupulous that whatever she should represent would be as certain as is seen by ourselves, with all these qualifications, as if selected and implanted by nature in one body for this express purpose, I could have no hesitation in confiding the enterprise of setting the standard for what a human being could look like to her. Thank you.
Ashe, well said, well written. Did we get everybody? Everybody who had a hand up, did you get an opportunity to share? Everybody who had a hand up? All right, I think we might have nabbed everybody. I was not sure how we were going to divvy out time in terms of if we were going to focus on workplace racism or if people just wanted to take that time to share their thoughts about Dr. Welsing, and you all kind of made the decision for me because there were so many people. It took a while to get through all of the folks who called in. I certainly do not want to block anyone if they had commentary on workplace racism, but since we pretty much went through all of that time, if folks had any other commentary they wanted to get on related to Dr. Welsing or comments on the clips, feel free to do so, even if you already shared, because I think we got all the people that called in, but if you have a hand up and have not shared, you should go ahead and speak now. But if folks had anything else they wanted to make sure they get in, we can take the last few minutes and folks can share.
Okay, I like to say something real quick, because I heard everyone's commentary on Dr. Welsing, and really, Gus, you do a great job. I mean, I don't know where my understanding would be without your show, and, you know, I love you a lot for what you do. It's just a great work, and I think that you've been carrying her legacy on, and and Mr. Fuller's as well. By doing the show all these years, having such an extensive archive that you could go back to. I mean, I don't know where my life would be without your show. Your show was just excellent to me. I have a better understanding of what's going on. And since he was on the line, I also wanted to thank caller from Alabama, because over the years, him and 404, but really him, you know, like the way he would question white people, I just loved it, you know. I just really got it just listening to the way he questioned them, and I want to thank him for participating in the show all these years, because he doesn't know how. I mean, at first I used to listen like, man, this guy Gus is crazy, but I got it after a while. So thank you very much.
Lots of people say that this guy Gus is crazy. Did we miss anybody? I thought it was somebody else. If you had comments, even if you've already shared, if you had something else you wanted to make sure you get in, feel free.
This is Puff again. I just wanted to say briefly that Alabama, I listened to the show the other day. I made up listen to it. I didn't listen to it at the first beginning, but I hope your hand do well. And I hope you do well with whatever you pursue on that, with that work situation. And that's all I want to say. Go ahead, everybody.
Chris Xavier?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this guy is from Alabama, and I'd like to thank Puff and the other caller for their comments. And I continue to learn from everybody on the program as well. And like I said, Gus T. Renegade and Dr. Nita Fuller and just the cows in general, all of the victims of racism on the cow has helped me a whole lot. And about what Puff was saying, thanks for asking. My hand is doing a lot better, and I'm starting a new job. I'm working for another victim of racism. This will be my first time working for a victim of racism. My goal for 2016 is to never work for a racist white supremacist or a suspected racist white supremacist ever again. That makes sense. And I am planning on starting my own business this year. I can comment on it on workplace racism when I get it off the ground, but hopefully by the beginning of the summertime I can. You know, I'll be able to have my own truck myself, you know. And I'll meet my line.
Hey.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, so just like to mirror the sentiments of some of the other callers, I'm very, very thankful for this show. It helped to expand my vocabulary in speaking about racism and white supremacy very exponentially. My understanding was pretty rich. But the verbiage, just listening to how you converse with the different guests, whether they're victims of white supremacy or whether they were white supremacists themselves or just suspected racists. I think they're all racist anyway, but I'll just use the better term for the moment. And you really helped to help me to understand the importance of words and the way to use them in a verbal conversation. Your calmness, your ability to be empathetic with other victims of white supremacy, your mental dexterity is phenomenal. Your memory is impeccable. And I believe in my heart you definitely are carrying the work on of Stanley Jr., Dr. Welsing, and all of the other great scholars. And one thing I'd like to say about Dr. Welsing is she had to have had one of the deepest wellsprings of love for people of African descent, of anybody who's walked the planet, to do all the work she's done for so long. And she's kind of like, to me, she reminds me of a female version of Dr. Ben, because Dr. Ben was a wellspring of love for African people. And we lost two major giants between 2015 and 2016, and that would be Dr. Ben and Dr. Welsing. And again, I'd just like to thank you for the show, for all the people who call in. Your questions and comments have expanded my consciousness and helped me to see things from different perspectives. And I'd just like to thank everyone that called me to the show regularly. And Gus, I wanted to let you know, too, my coworker who I introduced to your program is going through the archives. Her and her husband together, they listen to the show together, they discuss them, and from what she's gotten back to me about, she thoroughly loves the program. I'm hoping eventually she'll chime in at some point, but she definitely digs the program, and like I said, as many people of African descent, people are non-white people looking to understand the system of white supremacy that I can forward your program to, I will, and thanks again.
Appreciate that. That's following Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's lead, trying to help out as many black people as we can to get a better understanding and hopefully get more black minds focused on solving this problem immediately. Absolutely. Anybody else? Anything else they want to make sure they got in? I think I am hoping that it's in the recording from the Welsing Institute, that the last one that she conducted in December, where she said that she thinks Donald Trump is going to be next president. I'm hoping that it's in there, because I know she said it when I spoke with her in December. She was explaining, you know, why, and I mean, under the system of white supremacy, why that was her prediction, that he was going to go ahead and win. I'm hoping that it's in that recording. I'm going to go back and double check to see if it's there. If it's not, that would be a bummer. But I know she did convey that to me, that was her prediction right now, that she thinks Donald Trump is going to win the whole thing. But there was an article, all the work that she did, I know she would have appreciated, in the Washington Post this week. Donald Trump is the white guy's white knight. System of white supremacy. They are always making chess moves, acts of terrorism against non-white people, particularly black people. But it was in the Washington Post this week. Donald Trump is the white guy's white knight. I'll be sure to post it so you can read at your own leisure. Any other comments folks want to make? Oh, that I did the audio clip. I don't know if people can remember it, but they were commenting about just that, Donald Trump, racism, and why so many white people are supporting him. I thought it was profound. The caller dialed in. It was a non-white male. He called in. I think he said he was Caribbean, and he was talking about racism and, you know, his experiences, and he touched on demographics. There being fewer white people. Doctor, that's one point that she always hammered on. White people are a minority on the planet. Chuck D tweeted out today, just reminding people that Dr. Francis Cress Welsing was the inspiration for Fear of a Black Planet. I think a lot of people would submit that was their most successful, most powerful, probably one of the most important music recordings of all time. I know quite a few publications said that's, you know, easily one of the most important recordings that's come out in the last 25 years. But that interview, it was on WNYC, New York Public Radio, but he commented and he said that white people are not going to be the majority in this area of the world anymore. They're not in the world by far, but they're not going to be the majority in this area of the world. They're upset about that, and that's also fueling a lot of the support for Donald Trump. I thought it was profound when the person being interviewed, when he went to comment, there was all this distortion in the line and you couldn't hear. And they said, oh, well, you have to stop for a second. We have to get our engineer to work with you to see if we can clear your line. I thought that that was profound. Now, I mean, hey, we do a radio program. We have tech issues from time to time. I've commented when, you know, I made an error, and I've also commented when I, you know, cannot really tell what the problem is. It could be racist interference. It could just be a technical problem. It could have just been a technical issue, but I thought that that was very significant when they had a technical problem when he went to respond to what the caller brought up, if folks remember that from that segment from WNYC. Anywho, anything else folks want to get in before we wrap up? Any other comments folks want to make sure they get in?
One more thing. That's actually, yeah. I was going to say, I think that the timing was always perfect, and it probably was racist interference. But also, there was a funny thing that I just wanted people to ponder about. George Lucas, I saw an article where George Lucas came out apologizing, saying that he sold the Star Wars characters to white slaves at Walt Disney. He recanted the statement, and I just found that a very telling statement from a white man speaking about white slavers at Walt Disney. And come to find out, he sold his company, Lucasfilm, to Disney in 2012 for $4.6 billion. And then also I wanted to ask you guys if you got the email that I sent you regarding the two show suggestions for the two different white females.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Okay, great. I just wanted to know if you got it. Thanks again, and that's all I wanted to chime in with. Thanks very much.
For sure. For sure.
Hello?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
I just want to add on that the terms minority, that's another double-speak term that they use to just mean non-whites. Because even in the clip that you had earlier, they use this term also very often. It's going to be a majority minority. Wouldn't they just be the majority if these people were supposed to, if once you're in the minority and now there are more of you, you should be the majority. But they're using majority to just, I guess, I mean, I don't even know what they're using white as. They're using majority, minority. It's like a double negative for non-whites. That's all.
Agreed. Agreed. I thought I had heard a female voice as well. Was there a female caller that had something? Or anybody else, but I thought I did hear a female voice. Do you have something you wanted to make sure you got in?
Hi, Gus. May I make a statement real quick or ask you a question real quick?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you remember when Dr. Welsing was on the program? I think it was around the Charleston shooting. She made a statement about her home. Do you remember her speaking about she was this is basically the first thing she started speaking of before we start talking. She was talking about the issue that she was having in her home. Do you recall that? With her properties?
I know for, I think one she had talked about because they're quote-unquote gentrifying, a.k.a. racial dislocation, uh-huh. Moving a lot of black people out of the Washington, D.C. area. So I think she had commented on that, and it's totally related. I think for a while she had been talking about it was some nursery. I think she said it was like a Jewish daycare center or something where it was little children, little white children, quote unquote Jewish, but they were there and they were making a lot of noise, and that this was breaking the law, that this was a violation of the policy that whites have written for that particular area of D.C., that you're not supposed to have these daycare centers next to residential houses. There's supposed to be a certain amount of space if you're going to have these type of centers, because they know if the children are going outside that it's a lot of noise and what have you, and you can't disrupt property homeowners, as they say. But that's something that she had been going through for a while, and she felt that that was another part of that getting her, a black property owner, getting her out of Washington, D.C. But I think those were two issues that she had talked about on the program. I think the noise from this daycare center, she had talked about that on the program repeatedly, if you go back over the years on this program and others. And then I think just the general feeling, you know, that they're trying to push her out of that area. I think that's what you're referencing, unless I am mistaken. I just muted your line real quick because I was getting the background noise. Is that sounding like what you remember?
Yes, it is. It just kept sticking in my head, but I forgot to throw it out when I was speaking earlier, and it just kept sticking in my head because I remember she was speaking of that, and then when I look at everything now, sometimes I just wonder. I just wonder if that was a lot of pressure for her too, on top of everything else that she had going on. It just stuck in my head today. So I'm sorry about the background noise.
All good. Well, it's definitely not all good, but yeah, no, that is not a problem. That is not a problem.
Okay.
Person, they wrote in a comment. They said, what really impressed me about Dr. Welsing, although she was renowned for the work she has done and continued to do, however, she was not opposed to co-opting Mr. Fuller's work with hers. That's profound because, unfortunately, I think because of the system in which we exist, has conditioned our reaction to the point when we get together to talk about racism, we have a tendency to engage in a practice of showing off how much we know to each other. I commend her for her humility. And I think some of the other folks have pointed that out, that she consistently, might even say relentlessly, made sure to remind people to check out the work of Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. and even commenting the huge impact that his work had on her and her understanding of what system of white supremacy means. And I think that's something she is evidence in our archives and probably many others for the many different broadcasts and programs that she did down through the years, down through the decades. Anybody else?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and the callers. I just want to say it real quick. First off, I have been upset today finding out that sad news about Dr. Welsing, and she has had a tremendous effect on my mental development and my heightened alert of consciousness about system of racism. And I just really want to just share my appreciation for how her information has helped me out. And like everybody else has said, or many other people have said about how you've conducted all of those interviews were very professional, in my opinion, as well. And I just wanted to ask about it was a clip about the football segment, the concussion, and you used one of the audio segments of Dr. Welsing, and she was talking about, like, I know she uses that analogy about football and, like, the sports and stuff. I think she was saying we have to understand about when you have a football game or something like that and how black people are being shot. Do you recall what that was from by any chance?
That was from her last session of the Welsing Institute in December, just a couple of weeks ago. As I said, I got the audio from that. One of our listeners I was going to try to broadcast that. I had brought that up. I had called her. That was one of the last times I talked to her. And then I spoke with her again after that. But I was going to try to broadcast that live because one of our listeners, I think more than one of our listeners, was at that session. But she said that she actually, poet Danny Queen, who's also been a guest on the program, that he records those sessions and then they sell the CDs. And so she says they have a rule about no recording, no cell phone, all of that stuff. She had said, you know, since it's you all, I've been on your program so many times, we can see if we can make an exception in the future. And it just, you know, her transition happened before we could make it happen. But people did go and they got the recording and they shared with me. So like I said, I'm just going to see if I can check in with poet Danny Queen, if he is cool with us sharing it. I can play the whole thing, but that's where that segment is from, her last session with the Welsing Institute in December.
Thank you. I know I would really appreciate that, to hear that lecture. just wanted to say once, well, a second thing was, I think Dr. Wilson would say maybe in her definition about thought, speech, and action, and I think emotional response and symbol formation, like, I was thinking about like the real big problem with our emotions and how we respond. Like the one guy on my job, you know, how it just happened so abruptly and suddenly, he was calling me all kinds of slurs and epithets and whatnot. And my emotions, like I got control of my emotions. I was able to step away from that situation safely. And from my understanding, when that same guy seen me, maybe like a week or so later, it was just like he didn't even know how to even look at me anymore. Like he wouldn't even say anything, you know. And just that part right there alone is very powerful. And if I could share, it was another video I seen this week where it was I think it was somewhere up in Pennsylvania. It was a white person. He was, I guess he was approaching this group of protesters talking about something about an oil company or something. And the guy behind the camera apparently was a black person, and the white person kept looking into the camera, calling them a nigger and a monkey, making monkey noises, and the guy would not respond. He seemed like he was very calm and grounded and well in control of his emotions. And next thing you know, after maybe about 2 minutes of this, you know, the white guy, he just walks off. He just leaves. And I just think that was a very interesting example of that, about emotions. So, yeah, that's pretty much all I wanted to really share.
Ashe, hugely. And I know Dr. Welsing would co-sign on that. And that is another. Like I said, she had a lot of just tremendous qualities that I think we could learn a lot from and try and apply those to our own thought, speech, action, and emotional responses. But I think her just being so calm, I, you know, listened to Dr. Welsing when I could, regardless anybody's program that she was on. And I've heard people, even some victims, call in. And I mean, she would say this all the time. I have had it myself. People saying, I don't know who this Dr. Welsing woman is. She is crazy. You are a crackhead. I don't care what, you know, doctor this or degree. Blah, blah. I've heard that many times. And she had the same calm, cool, collected response and not, you know, jumping up and down and just still, hey, this is my explanation. If you have a different view, that's fine too. And just that sort of response and just being super patient with other victims of racism and just consistently modeling the highest levels of black self-respect. Definitely think that that's something that we can apply. And even, you know, as you just said with racists, I think just getting to that point where we can be in control of our emotions. Obviously, you're human, so, you know, it's sometimes you get upset or you get sad or whatever the case may be. But in terms of name calling and that sort of thing, I think we can all get that A+ where we do not respond. We understand what it is. We're not surprised. And I'm not responding to that at all. You are just confirming my analysis that we are indeed in a system of racism, white supremacy, and you are just being the white savage that Ben Tillman talked about in the Reconstruction of White Supremacy. I'm not surprised. This is what I expect from you. Anybody else? Final comments before we wrap up? We will, you know, have to. This will not be the last day that we have thoughts on Dr. Welsing and her work and impact. But anything else folks want to make sure they get in before we wrap up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, thank you for unmuting me. I would like to recite Dr. Welsing's prayer. As you recall, one time, it was one of the last times she was on the program, and someone asked her to do it, and she said that she would have had to go find the paper, something like that, to recite it, so it kind of like, you know, passed by on the program. But I have it right in front of my face, and if, with your permission, at the end of the program, you know, you normally recite the prayer. And I was just calling in to state that I would like to recite her prayer, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. That would be a fitting way to conclude things. We will give you the privilege, sir. The caller at 5973, did you have comments you wanted to make sure you got in?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everybody. Thanks for taking my call. I just call in to give a note of solidarity and everything about the transition of Dr. Francis Questwell Singh. When you had on the show at one time I called up, you know, it was like I was meeting the person. That's how special that woman is to me, because in the 90s I had got a book also, you know. So the only time that I ever met her was on your show, and to me it was like it was like standing right before, you know what I mean? And what I wanted to pass on was, she says that black self-respect is more powerful than a nuclear bomb. That was like something she said a lot, you know, and it probably didn't register as a powerful statement completely. But now you can hear that much clearer, you know. So what also came to me was that there's a power in the transitioning, and there's a power in the silence, like, you know. And about that self-respect, you know, like the brother was saying, you can hear a person on our program like this, certain people participating, and then the way they come across to you, you may think there's something whack or off, but there's something basically off about all of us on this journey of understanding. But when you come to a more mature state, you realize how important we all really are. And I'll leave it like that.
Ashe. Ashe. Unless somebody else had a quick comment they wanted to get in, we will leave it there. Our retired firefighter will do the prayer at the end, but unless somebody else had a quick comment they wanted to get in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Well, sorry, man, it's so late. I just wanted to tell you, a lot of times we got to remember the power of our ancestors, you know, who has transitioned. And just like in Catholicism, they make people saints and things of that nature. I do believe in the power of the ancestors. And since she worked so hard all of her life against racism and in the field of psychiatry, if you were ever having problems with dealing with racism or any type of psychological problems that you might dealing with stress or anything of that nature, I think it would probably help us as victims of racism when we're by ourselves to call on the ancestor, Dr. Francis Quest Wilson, for help, guidance, and protection. And I really do know the power of the ancestors. They will help.
Right on. Absolutely. I know Dr. Rasayan, he's been on the program many, many times. As I said, he was the person that informed me that she had transitioned this morning. And he'll probably be stopping through to give his thoughts and remembrance. He said that we can burn candles for her made from beeswax and incense, sandalwood, frankincense, myrrh, and amber, and just recognizing the importance of our ancestors and those who might not be here with us in a physical form, and just still the power
that they have and can aid us in trying to solve this problem. I think when he was on the program in 2014, which was year of transition where we lost a lot of people, Dr. Maya Angelou and Ruby Davis, Yuri Kochiyama, Amiri Baraka, Sam Greenlee. It was just time. I am certain I'm leaving people out because it was so many people that we lost that year who had just, same thing, devoted their life to working against racism, white supremacy. But he said that the enormity of this problem and whites are amplifying. They're doing so much in terms of the terrorism against us that some of these ancestors in crossing over that they might be able to do more to help us solve this problem and making us recognize the significance of their lives and what they did, that in addition to everything that they can do from the ancestral realm to help us, guide us, and give us the power needed to solve this problem. I think he would definitely encourage us to remember that and again, just to reflect on Dr. Welsing's life, her teachings, just the enormous amount of work that she did and left us with. I mean, I'm sure you could spend months going through YouTube and all the different videos and things of her work and different talks that she gave and radio programs that are available online. It would take you days just with the time that she spent on this program. It would take you literally days to listen to everything all the way from 2009 all the way up to November of 2015. So again, and I think one of the main things that you're going to hear in all of those different conversations over the years is Black self-respect. Black self-respect echoed over and over and over, and I would submit strongly demonstrated in the way that she conducted herself for the entire time that I saw her on the planet, with the highest levels of Black self-respect. So hopefully that's something, again, all of us who were touched by her work, appreciated what she did, impacted by her scholarship, we can reflect that moving forward, Black self-respect in the way that we treat ourselves, the way that we treat other Black people. I will be working to post Facebook and tweet out all 30 of the programs that Dr. Welsing did with us over the years, so folks can go back and check them out. Share if you think, you know, it would be constructive, if you think it would benefit other victims of racism. Share, but that's something I'll be doing over the next 24 hours to make those available. And then, as I said, we'll be working to have other folks to come through who were impacted by Dr. Welsing's efforts to come through and give their thoughts, remembrances over the next days, weeks, months. This will not be the last time that we recognize her incredible efforts and the impact that she had on us. With that, huge thanks to everyone for dialing in. I can speak for myself. I know it was a difficult day for me, and it was very helpful to hear from everybody, and kind words about Dr. Welsing and thoughts and prayers to her family from everybody was super helpful. I'm sure that was a big aid to other people as well who are having a tough time today. And just, again, what Dr. Welsing said, be not discouraged. That is something she said on the program, and I heard that again today, just going back in the archives, be not discouraged. She had extremely high expectations of Black people, particularly Black people who were students of her work, in knowing that we had the ability to solve this problem and that, you know, we should manifest that if we really had some care and concern for what she did in her time on the planet. We will be back. Just check Black Talk Radio Network. You can check the Facebook page as well for the times we'll be broadcasting this week. You can just go to the Facebook page, facebook.com/RWSWJ, and you'll see all the information. I post the events there. You'll see it. It'll also be at Black Talk Radio Network. Again, I would encourage folks to be as safe as possible. And I guess I'd also take this time to again encourage. I mean, with Dr. Welsing, she did live to be 80. I mean, under the system of racism, white supremacy, that is, you know, a lot of us do not get to 80. Tamir Rice, a lot of us do not get to 80. Even that is short. I think we would be here much, much longer and have much more healthy and productive lives if we could get rid of this system, if we did not have to deal with whites. That being said, everybody, myself, everybody who says, hey, I'm trying to work to solve this problem with racism, white supremacy, it cannot be understated the value of your life, of what you're doing. If you, you know, think you're a little bit less confused about racism, white supremacy, and you're trying to share work and do things to solve this problem, you are immensely valuable. Just imagine if Dr. Welsing had not taken care of herself, if she just sat around and ate crazy food all day long and smoked cigarettes and drunk alcohol every day and not been able to be productive. She was going to be 81 in March. To be doing the Welsing Institute and going out and doing what she did, if she had not taken care of herself, it is hugely important. I would even say that is a manifestation of black self-respect. Really make an effort to take quality, excellent care of yourself. If you are doing something against racism, white supremacy, I mean, just man, the pain that we're experiencing now. If you could imagine if Dr. Welsing had been like Natalie Cole and left us at 65. Value black life, value your life, particularly if you, you know, are trying to do something about racism, white supremacy. You might have something that you're doing later in life in your 40s, 50s that, you know, ends up solving this problem or ends up being hugely constructive and helpful for black people. So I would just echo that. I think that's something that Dr. Welsing would certainly co-sign on. In that vein, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. We want to do everything that we can to minimize contact with enforcement officials. Certainly, if you're going to be out and about, I know they're still going to be out in full force because this is quote unquote holiday weekend. Man, you do not want to be under the influence if you are behind the wheel, if you are a passenger, even a pedestrian. Race soldiers are constantly looking to make problems for us. Whites are constantly looking to make problems for us. You never know when it's going to be Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson that pulls you over. We want to be lucid, making the best possible decisions to keep ourselves safe and anybody that you might be responsible for. Buckle up if you're going to be behind the wheel. Again, minimize contact with enforcement officers. I would submit you do not want to be around intoxicated whites. I'm sure there's a lot of that going on this weekend. That is an extremely dangerous environment. It can go from zero to lethal in seconds, and I would even exercise caution. Really, I would discourage being around other non-white people if they're under the influence. We already got enough problems on our plate. We do not need unnecessary strife and conflict. With that said, again, huge thanks to everyone for tuning in. Be not discouraged. Be not discouraged. We will have lots more to say about Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. If anything, be on your assignment. That is what she would want us to do. I think the biggest respect, compliment that we can give her is to do everything that we can to solve this problem, the system of white supremacy. Retired firefighter in Florida, if you want to give us the prayer to wrap things up, we will close out.
Thank you, sir. I am going to dedicate what I'm saying to the living memory of the spirit of Miss Frances Cress Welsing, M.D. It's entitled A Liberating Black People's Prayer for Justice and Peace. And she states to say and envision when in prayer. Thou who art blacker than a trillion midnight, whose eyes shine brighter than a billion suns. Thou whose hair doth coil tighter than a million springs, radiating all energy throughout the universe. We beseech thee, one and only one, to give us total strength to carry out thy will for the universe, to establish justice on planet Earth and live in peace. Thank you.
Ashe.
Ashe. Ashe.
Context.
You're like a bubbly 12-year-old.
Right on. Thank you. Thank you. Context of white supremacy. Signing out. Thanks all for tuning in. Thank you, Dr. Welsing.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.